everybody, we're live. Sorry about the 5-minute delay there. All right. I took a flight last week, and I saw two sites that I thought were noteworthy for nerds like us. So, first...
Wait, you saw somebody using Overcast in the wild?
Saw someone using Overcast while wearing a Vision Pro.
Neither of those things.
That's impressive.
Well, I don't know how you would see that. But
exactly.
But first, here, I'll send this picture in Slack. I saw this across the aisle and ahead by one seat. What app is he using?
Flighty?
That's right. That is our friend Ryan Jones's app, Flighty.
Yeah.
This is... Look, I'm always looking to see what people are using on their on planes and trains and stuff.
Is this a rare site? Isn't Flighty, like, super popular?
I think it... But I sent it to Ryan, and he said he's never seen it in the wild either. So not only was this person using Flighty... The guy behind him was also using Flighty.
Everybody should be using Flighty. Like, I don't even fly that much, but, like, seriously, if you don't have Flighty, I fly so rarely, but it's still worth it for me to track other people's flights. I track my family's, like, my wife travels for work a lot. I have Flighty just to track her flights. I'm not even the one flying. It's still worth it.
Yeah, it's fantastic.
And I should briefly interject that when Flighty was new, it was priced fairly, but for someone who flies only a couple times a year, I found it to be very expensive. But since that time, and I'm not saying their price was unfair, it's just because I never fly, I didn't really, you know, need it. But they've since added a, like, pay as you go, like a weekly plan, which is $5 a week.
Which sounds like I don't fly that much. Like, it's, I think it's something like $50 or $60 a year if you want the yearly plan. But I don't fly that often, so I just every time I fly somewhere, I just buy the week pass and then end it when I'm back. And then next time I fly, I buy another week pass. It's super easy.
Compared to how much you get charged for, like, a nickel and dime for stuff on flights, $5 for Flighty is well worth it.
Absolutely. That's my whole point, is that I think a lot of people, myself included, initially were like, oh, I'd love that, but it's out of reach expensive. But it's actually not. They've adjusted their pricing over the years such that it really is affordable, even for a cheapskate like me. So if you haven't looked at Flighty in a long time, you should check it out again, because, like I said, there are plans that are much less costly, or perhaps maybe a better way of looking at it is more attuned to a flyer of my frequency, which is to say, like, twice a year.
Yeah, it's $5 for a week. It's like if you buy a bottle of water in the airport, you're like, it's so
it's
relative
so
to, you know, the rest of air travel, it's nothing.
Yep.
So not only was this guy using Flighty on, by the way, on an iPhone Air, which is the first time I've seen anyone with an iPhone Air in the wild.
Yeah, I didn't notice that.
Yeah, I thought it might be, and then I convinced myself I was wrong. We probably won't put this picture in the show notes because
I don't want to, just in case, you know.
But suffice to say, it looks ever so slightly looks like an Air, and as it turns out, apparently it was.
Yes. This guy, he was a tech enthusiast. You can tell because he was carrying multiple phones. He had an iPhone Air and some kind of Android something. He was kind of alternating between them, and he had the entire flight, he was using a 13-inch OLED iPad Pro as his main entertainment device. So, like, this guy was obviously, like, a nerd of some kind. but nothing compared to the nerd that was sitting behind him, who was also using Flighty here and there. Here, I'll send the second picture to the guy.
Oh, look at that.
There he is.
Look at that. So we're looking at a picture of a gentleman with a Vision Pro on. It's hard to tell. You know, you can't really tell if it's an M5 Vision Pro or not, but I can tell you it 100% has the new dual knit, whatever they call it, headband, which is the Pro Move. And this man looks like he is watching a movie and living his best life.
This is the first time I've seen a Vision Pro being used in the wild outside of, like, Apple events. So this man was using a Vision Pro for the entire flight. He was, based on the fact that he was not moving his hands most of the time, I could tell that he was mostly probably just watching a movie or something the whole time. But I did see him do the relatively complicated, like, bring up control center and change the volume gesture where you turn your hand upside down. And, like, I saw him do that once. Now, this is the brand new strap. This picture was taken last week, one day after the strap came out. So, and the new Vision Pro came out. So I'm thinking, like, and he had a third party case that is not sold in Apple stores. So I'm thinking he probably did not just buy the Vision Pro that day or the day before.
Sure.
Because no one on their day two of Vision Pro ownership, nobody would know that gesture. the volume adjustment, right. Like, you know, weird hand turn upside down thing.
I knew it on day two of having Casey's. Well,
but you're an exception to the rule, okay. Sir. But I do take your point, but you're an exception. You know, unless it could be, and I hope this doesn't come across in a bad way, because I mean this genuinely, but like, what if this was, he doesn't strike me from the way he looks. Again, I'm sorry, there's no picture in the show notes, but doesn't strike me as a person who has saved up for 2 years to buy a Vision Pro. But like, in the occasions when I am really amped about getting something and I save my money for it, you bet that me, of all people, has read the manual front to back, inside and out 13 times before it arrives.
If you bought it and had a flight, you'd definitely be using it on a flight, just like you were trying to set up your new phone on the way to the airport.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly.
But yeah, so but because you have the third party case, so my theory is either he's a John and has read everything and did everything and even maybe pre-ordered the case, or he has either bought both Vision Pros, or he at least bought the new strap on day one and then immediately took a flight with it. But I got to say, seeing it in the wild, first of all, you know, congratulations on Apple. You at least sold one more Vision Pro than the ones we bought. But also, like, it looked really stupid on it. Like, I got it. And look, the guy seemed, I mean, he didn't seem like a, you know, nothing. I don't know anything about the guy. Maybe he's a nice guy. It was a weird look to see on a plane, to be honest. Like, but we did find like one person in the wild who uses the Vision Pro on an airplane.
I've done it once or twice. I've done it, and you do look like a moron. But let me tell you, if you can get over the fact that you look like a moron, you are having far and away the best plane experience on that plane, except maybe the drunk person behind you. But other than the drunk person behind you, you are having the best experience on that plane, way better than anyone else's.
Yeah, people honestly wear sleep masks and stuff on the plane too, right? They have weird, those weird neck pillows. They have sleep masks. Yeah. People don't care what they look like on the plane. They're just trying to get comfortable.
Well, I can say like the. I didn't want to like stare too much, so I didn't get too much of a look at the guy. But like, it seems like the interactions with the flight attendants were awkward. And he
did he not take the thing off?
Oh no, yes,
he didn't take it off the whole flight.
You gotta take it
off.
And
you had,
he also didn't take it off during the in-flight meal.
That's now, also too
have
much.
Have you ever tried to like drink something out of a glass while wearing a Vision Pro?
You know, people eat with beards too, if you can believe it.
Wow. Yeah, but like, email John, please. Not me. Email John.
I guess you get food in your mustache and your beard. It's easier to clean out than if you wedge it up inside your Vision Pro.
No, I will say that I am in full support of using the Vision Pro for like a movie or whatever on the plane, or perhaps as a second screen for your laptop. But to me, I draw the line at, if you know that like food service is happening, you are not immersed, and you, the moment you are spoken to, that thing at least gets perched on the top of your head, so you don't like not literally lose the connection, but so it doesn't like do a re-off once you put it back down. You don't have to necessarily take it all the way off your head, but at least perch it up on like your forehead and have that interaction face to face, and then you can go back to your immersive world afterward.
Yeah,
or
if someone talks to you and you're wearing AirPods, even if you're in transparency mode, the polite thing to do is to take out at least one and ideally both AirPods, you indicate to the person like, I'm not being antisocial here. I know you're talking to me and I'm trying to be courteous and respond to you. And like, yeah, it's not that like, you know, the stewardess like figured it out, but it seemed like kind of an antisocial mechanic. And it's like, okay, it would be better even if you can see through it, even if, and seeing your eyes on the weird displays does not count. Even if you can see through it, it is better to like just lift it up when someone's talking to you.
Yep, I couldn't agree more.
Yeah. Anyway, I was very excited to see these things being used in the wild. It was, you know, both the iPhone Air, two copies of Flighty, because when this guy was using his iPhone, I caught him using Flighty also. And then, so two different people using Flighty, a Vision Pro in real life, an iPhone Air in real life. It was quite a fun scene for an Apple fan to be sitting next to these guys.
And not to blow up your whole spot, but were you flying to like San Francisco or something like that? Or were you flying
no.
to a regular person?
I was flying to a regular, like a non-tech notable city.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. That's fascinating. That's awesome. I am in full support of all of this, to be honest, with the exception, like I said, of not pulling the Vision Pro off when you're talking to people. But other than that, heck yeah, you live your best life. All right, we should do a little bit of shilling. Let's talk about the ATP Holiday Store, which is back, baby, at atp.fm/store. John, can you take us through maybe not every single product, but at least the highlights or the new products for this season, please?
Yeah, so to start off with the Chicken Hat 2.0, new version of our Chicken Hat, our reproduction of my really old hat. It's a little bit bigger than the old one, and the logo's in the middle, but that's not the important part. We have some important Chicken Hat follow-up from Ben Kane. Last episode, I was trying to describe the chicken hat for people who'd never heard of it. And I said, well, you know, when you put it on, like, it's kind of, it looks kind of like a triangle on top of your head. And when you wear it, it's like vertically, you know, it makes like a ridge in your head, kind of like the comb on a rooster. And I had said, you know, a rooster, I know it's not technically a chicken, but you know what I mean? Like the little flappy thing that's on the top of the head of chicken. Ben Kane writes, a rooster is in fact a chicken. Male chickens are roosters. Female chickens are hens. That is all. Thank you, Ben, for the clarification. I feel better about describing it as a comb on a rooster. So anyway, the Chicken Hat 2.0 is there. Limited quantities. We had to guess how much we would sell. We haven't sold them all yet. Hopefully we will sell them all. But if you want one, you should get one because they might sell out or we might be selling them for the next 5 years. We'll see. And speaking of selling out, the mugs have sold out. Thank you, everybody. Last episode we had 10 mugs. When we finished recording the episode, we had 10 mugs. So nobody in the live chat room bought them. But subsequently, people have bought them. The mugs are sold out. Hallelujah. The mugs are sold out. other new notable products, we've got an ATP quarter zip, which is proving popular for people who don't like their zippers to go all the way down. It's got an embroidered ATP logo. Looks nice. We have the ugly ATP Tahoe shirt to... memorialize Tahoe, which we may talk about in the topic section. We have the very popular ATP T568A and T568B Ethernet wiring standard shirts that transform our logo, like to change the six-color apple stripe things in the ATP logo to be the colors of the conductors, so the wire jackets in Ethernet connectors, according to these two different standards. There's different wires in different orders. If you know, you know. Lots of people asked.
Hold on. Are you going to talk about quantities? That's exactly
yes.
what I was about to
do. Lots of people asked, how is that going? How's 568A versus 568B? What is selling more? I can tell you that right now, it's basically 2-to-1 B to A. B is selling twice as much as A right now. Now, on that topic, because I always forget which one of these is which, so I went to the Wikipedia page, because I personally don't have any experience in working with these wires. I've never crimped an Ethernet connector, although I've seen these wires inside them, and I'm aware of it conceptually. So I don't know the cultural... You know, I don't know what the cultural weight of these different standards, but I'm kind of surprised that it's 2-to-1 B to A. Here's what Wikipedia has to say on this briefly. Sorry for the tangent. The 568 standard recommends T568A pinout for horizontal cables. This pinout is compatible with one pair and two pair universal service order codes, or USOC pinouts. The U.S. government requires it, that is, it requires 568A, in federal contracts. The standard also allows only in certain circumstances the T568B pinout, quote, if necessary to accommodate certain 8-pin cabling systems, i.e. when and only when adding to an existing installation that uses a T568B wiring pattern. In the 1990s, when the original standard was published, the most widely installed wiring pattern in unshielded twisted pair cabling infrastructure was AT&T's 258A Systemax, hence the inclusion of the same wiring pattern as T568B as a secondary option for use in such installations. Many organizations still use T568B out of inertia. So all you B people out there, 2-to-1, B, are you using B out of inertia? Because you're using an existing thing that used the AT&T 258A Systemax standard in the 1990s. Why 2-to-1 B? It seems like A is the recommendation. I recall from our older conversation that one of these was compatible with like telephone system, like analog telephone system wiring, and the other one wasn't. But these two paragraphs from Wikipedia don't tell me which is which. But are you still using T568B out of inertia? Did you buy the B T-shirt out of inertia? 2-to-1 B to A. Fascinating. I'm assuming this won't change. I don't want to change anyone's mind. Say, but you pick whatever you want. You know, B or A. I just lots of people really like B. Some people we have some follow up maybe next week or something saying that they weren't even aware that there were other ways to do it. Like they just did B or just did A, and that was just the that's just the order they go in. What do you mean there's another way? So anyway, we've got shirts for both. And we've got our M5 shirt and our Mac Pro Believe shirt and all our other ATP stuff. That's it for the store. We've got, I think, one more week where we're going to talk about the store. So don't dilly-dally. If you want something from the store, you should get it now. Oh, and we have ATP membership, gift memberships available as well. You can buy them anytime, so you don't have to buy them during the store thing. But just FYI, if you sign in to ATP.fm with your membership account, or even if you don't have a membership, just sign in to ATP.fm with the account that you made that you can buy membership or not with, you will get a link on the store page. You can email that link to anybody who you want to buy you an ATP membership for the holidays. Say, hey, I want an ATP membership. Follow this link. It'll let you buy one. All it does is pre-fill your email address in a form. But, you know, the email address has to match the email address that you sign into ATP.fm with. So, anyway, gift memberships as well. So, yeah, tune in next week for our final pitch for ATP merch. But that's what we've got.
Since John was courteous enough to speedrun that pitch, I will just tell you that this is the time where I remind you that every single sale, someone will tweet at me and say, oh, no, I'm that person that forgot to do it. So if you're driving, use your turn signal like an adult and pull over and go to hp.fm/store and make your purchase. If you're walking, meander your way to the side that is not traveled, typically the right in places like America, you know, kind of pull over as you're walking and go to atp.fm/store and make your purchase. Do not forget. Do not be that person. You will be made fun of mercilessly. Not really, but still, I will laugh. Don't be that person. atp.fm/store. All right, Vision Pro. Let's talk Vision Pro. And, you know, it's hard to argue with you or Marco when you talk Vision Pro things, particularly about blurriness, because I know that even though I have like 20/20 vision in one eye and like 20/25, 20/30 in the other eye when I have my contacts in, I'm not going to sit here and say I have stellar vision. Like, even if clinically like measured vision is sufficient, I don't have stellar vision. And so it's hard for me to make a real, you know, full-throated pitch or defense of the Vision Pro when it comes to blurriness. But we had some feedback with regard to John's lamenting that the Mac Virtual Display was no good. So, John, can you tell me about this, please?
Yeah, I had said that basically using Mac Virtual Display with my 2019 Mac Pro and my Pro Display XDR basically unretinaed my display. Like, the display was the same as it was in physical space, only now when I'm looking at it in virtual space, it looks like it was no longer a retina display. Thomas Cheng was one of many people to write in to point out that Mac Virtual Display, when used with an Intel Mac, is only up to 3K resolution. And I had said, can you believe this works with Intel? Well, apparently it does work with Intel. Sort of. It's limited to 3Ks. We'll link to the Apple support document about this. Apple Silicon is up to 5K, and with Sequoia 15.2 or later, you can go up to ultra wide, which is like 10,000 by 2,800 pixels. And by the way, a 1.5K would be a true non-retining of a 6K display, because, you know, every non-retina pixel becomes 4 retina pixels. So that's how that math works. I did try the Vision Pro. Once I learned this, I tried it with one of my Apple Silicon Macs. It's way clearer. It's clearer to the point where I feel like now the clarity is being limited by the displays in the Vision Pro. Again, as we talked about when we did the math on this when the product first came out, it's not as sharp. There's not enough pixels inside that display for it to be as sharp as an actual retina display. But boy, is it better. Going from 3K to 5K does make a significant difference. In fact, I was using it with the studio display connected to a Mac Studio, fittingly. And I did the thing where you're like, I made the virtual display the same resolution as the physical display, and I put it directly on top of the physical display. You know how like it snaps to like, maybe you don't know. When you're moving the virtual display around, it will snap to the vertical surface of the display, like it knows that the display is there. And then you can size it so that you're looking, like, you know, put pass-through on and everything. You're looking at your room, you're looking at your display, only what you're seeing is not the light-up pixels that are in your display. I think the display is turned off when Mac Virtual Display is happening. Mm-hmm. Instead, what you're seeing is the virtual display, and that's a great A-B test. And yeah, it does look a lot better. It's not as sharp as the display, but it is way better than 3K.
By the way, just to save us some email, John, you're totally wrong that 1.5K is not the non-retina of 6K. 6K is not talking about the area of the screen. It's talking about how wide it is on the horizontal dimension. The Pro Display XDR is 6,016 pixels across the top, and it's, you know, equivalent in size to a non-retina that would be 3,008 pixels across the top. So 3K really is the non-retina.
6K is not the total number of pixels?
Nope, it's 6016 by something.
Well, we should do the math to see if it comes out.
And 5K was, you know, 5120, I think, by something.
Yeah. No, now that you say that, you're exactly right, Marco. Well, but I didn't even think about it.
6,000? Yeah, I guess so. I mean, the K's are annoying.
You can guess so, but it's correct.
Yeah. Well, but the like, what is 4K, though, resolution-wise?
It's either 4096 or 3840.
Right, but there's none of those are 4,000. So it's 3,800 like almost 4,000.
Yeah,
not
they round. Right. There's differences in standards between TV and other things, but it's 3840 is the most common one, right?
We should do the multiplication to see what the actual, like, I don't know, you, because there's no K number for that. I guess there's no like the equivalent of 4K or whatever to that.
Well, because some of them are over 4,000, right? Yeah, Casey, what's the real?
The movie projection industry uses 4096 by 2160, which is DCI 4K, in television 3840 by 2160, or 4K UHD, with a 16:9 aspect ratio as the dominant standard.
Yeah, so and for computer monitors, 2560 by 1600 was the old, like, you know, big monitor size, and then 5K was doubled the 2560.
Oh, yeah, yeah, 5120. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Mm-hmm. And then the XDR, it got a little bit bigger, but it was already Retina. So there kind of was no 1X, like, 3000.
What is the XDR again?
6016 by something.
6016 by something.
Yeah, I don't know. I at least know that part. Come on.
I don't know.
All right, well, I'm looking it up. I'm looking it up.
Yeah.
Hold on.
Yeah, I just want to do the math.
And then secondly, while you're doing that, again, like, for people who might be expecting, like, how this looks in the Vision Pro, everything in a Vision Pro, and this is true of pretty much any kind of VR thing, everything rendered in a VR headset is going through a lot of different levels of sampling and of, like, warping of the image and de-warping of the image. You know, between, you know, what you're viewing, like, what's being rendered in the world is, you know, a polygon that shows your computer monitor textured onto it that could itself be positioned somewhere in your field of view, possibly at an angle and not taking up all the pixels in your field of view. And then your field of view is, you know, a square-ish screen that's being warped to create, like, a dome around you with optics. And so there are more pixels per inch in the middle of the field of view than there are as you get closer to the edges because of that warping effect. So the number of pixels being theoretically rendered, like, of the source monitor in a polygon rendered in a warped view, like, you're going through a lot of different levels of sampling and warping here, so it's never going to be sharp, and you're going to end up seeing effectively far fewer pixels than what these numbers actually are.
Well, I mean, it could be sharp if the displays had way more pixels, but as we calculated when the thing came out, even dead center in the displays, the best case scenario, it doesn't have the number of pixels per degree as the actual screen does at normal viewing distances. And
correct.
Speaking of getting close, I did try that. Like, what if I shove my face real close to the virtual display, which happens to be mapped onto my physical display? I think it makes it disappear when you get too close or something. Like, it doesn't, there's a point of diminishing returns where it gets angry that you're coming too close to it, and
it's shy, it doesn't want you to see its flaws.
Yeah, and anyway, like, obviously if your nose is touching the monitor, you can't really use the monitor at that distance. So yeah, I did it's 6016 by 3384, and that's about 20 million pixels. It's the 1.5K thing is interesting because the number of points is 3008 by 1692, so it's kind of like 3K points but 6K pixels, if you're going to use the 6K terminology. And I don't know what, like, when Apple says it's limited to 3K, do they mean it's literally limited to 3008 by 1692? You know, again, throwing out these casual K numbers for things that are more exact in number of pixels is difficult to understand. But it seems like 3K, if judging by Apple's pattern of using 6K for its monitors, it seems like 3K may literally be a direct unretining of the 6K display.
All right. Then Nick says, let me try this again. I'm sorry. Hold on. I fell over myself because I realized this is someone who I don't know if we wanted, if they wanted to say
their
surname.
You can just say first name. It's fine.
Okay. Sorry. Well, I can't, but then they credited them. They have one name in their email, like the from line on their email. And then they have
we
one.
We did a whole thing from this whole follow up from the same person, first name and last name last time. So I don't think that's a big deal, but you can just do first name. It's fine.
Yeah. Sorry. I'm just going to do first name because I'm scared now. Sorry, Marco. I totally destroyed that. I will give you a whole new edit point starting momentarily. Goodbye, future Marco.
Bye.
All right, and then Nick wrote to point out, which is something I knew but didn't think of in the heat of the moment, tapping and holding on the X, which if you imagine a Vision Pro window, and you don't have to have Vision Pro to have seen this, under the Vision Pro window is a bar that's very similar to the affordance for swiping, you know, the like app switching affordance on the phone. And it's just a horizontal bar. And to the left of that horizontal bar, there's a circle with an X. And Nick writes, tapping and holding the X lets you hide other windows. And the context here was John saying, there is no window management in the Vision Pro, which is mostly true. But Nick reminded me that, and reminds us that if you tap and hold the X, it'll let you hide every other window.
Yeah, that goes a long way towards solving my problem, which is like, I don't want all these other windows there, but I also don't want to close them, but I also don't want to move them to the sides. Just hide others. That really helps.
Yep. All right. So then there's something in the show notes, in our internal show notes, Vision Pro fit in ski goggles.
Mention this last time. Talking about how the thing fits on my face and wondering if I had the right size light shield and all that. And I was thinking about ski goggles because Vision Pro looks like ski goggles. and I have experience wearing ski goggles. And I'm like, these fit issues, why did I never have this problem with ski goggles? And the answer is that ski goggles, even though they look very similar and they even have the same kind of like foam around like the part that smushes against your face, the thing with ski goggles is the goggles themselves are made of flexible plastic, rubberized plastic, and they bend. They bend around your face. So whatever size and shape your face is, they curve in kind of a U shape, and the strap pulls them against your face and it bends them, and then the foam makes up for the lumps of your face and all the other stuff. And Vision Pro, obviously the aluminum part is not bending, at least you hope. Now the light shield in theory could accommodate this by being more accordion-like, but the light shield seems pretty rigid. Like, it's the light shield will deform a little bit, and it does have the interchangeable foamy pads on them, but the sort of the gray body of the light shield, I wonder if they made that more accordion-like, more squishy, so that it would that pressing it against your face would mold that. I guess part of the problem is that in ski goggles, the straps are pulling the plastic thing back on your face, but the straps don't attach to the light shield, so there's nothing pulling the light shield back on your face, right? Like, that's why I was saying I had little gaps by my temples, because nothing is pulling that back on my face. Now, obviously, the entire metal frame is pushing the light shield against my face, but you don't want that to push too hard. So anyway, that's just my thought on the fit of this. I think if they make a second version of this, they should consider making the light shield more compliant. I'm not suggesting they make the body of it bend, although they should make it out of plastic, but I understand making the body of it bend is unfeasible with precisely aligned motorized displays inside there. Like, I get that's not going to happen, but that's my thought about fit for another week of wearing this thing.
I would like to quiz you, perhaps not right now, but I'd like to quiz you more about your experiences with the Vision Pro. So let me just start by asking, you know, or set the stage. Have you been using it much over the last week since we last spoke about it, or has it been put away already?
I used it a few more times. It's still sitting on the desk. I'm still experimenting with it. So yeah, we can talk about it maybe in the after show.
All right, good deal. All right, Andy Lang writes, now that vapor chamber cooling is a thing in the iPhone, do you think this technology would come to the fanless M5 MacBook Air? I have an M3 MacBook Air, and sometimes it does get quite hot. And then Mark Gurman wrote, when was this? Recently, because I can't tell. But Mark Gurman wrote, a vapor chamber in the iPad Pro is on the roadmap. Note I said iPad Pro, not MacBook Air. Apple is now working on the feature with plans to integrate it as soon as the next round of updates. The company's on an 18-month upgrade cycle for the iPad Pro, suggesting that the vapor chamber could be added around spring of 2027. A vapor chamber would help distinguish the iPad Air and iPad Pro lines. The Air has been drifting further into high-end territory. It got a Pro size 13-inch screen for 2024 and is set to receive an M4 chip next year. So that doesn't answer the question about the Air, but it does mention the iPad Pro, quite obviously.
Yeah, so I think the vapor chamber is particularly useful for devices where you want to move heat and they have to be really thin, because if you watch that vapor chamber video we linked ages ago, the key feature of the vapor chamber is really, really thin. So if you're going to put this in a phone or in an iPad, and the iPad Pro is even thinner than the phone, you want something thin. In the MacBook Air, they could just use a thermal pad or like a, you know, maybe there's not enough room for a heat pipe, but like they have more options in the MacBook Air. That said, no one's going to turn their nose up at a vapor chamber in a MacBook Air, and it's conceivable that the MacBook Air could get thinner over time. So I think it is an appropriate, I think the MacBook Air could use better heat movement. Let's put it that way. I mean, we've seen that with Maxtech always breaks them open and like adds whatever cooling thing they can think of inside there, new thermal pads or some other thing, and that just makes such a huge difference. And so you're like, there's room to make the MacBook Air spread its heat better, and if it's not a vapor chamber, then something would be useful. So I think Andy has a good idea, but it seems like Apple is going to put them into the iPad before they get to the MacBook Air, at least according to Gurmer's rumors so far.
I am a little curious, though. Like, you know, we heard in the past, and I believe this has been verified, that like the MacBook Air, because of various like safety requirements, that laptops can't get above a certain exterior temperature because it'll burn people's laps, and certain, you know, certain regulatory requirements, or maybe just conventions. I don't know, but basically, that the MacBook Air does not conduct the heat from the processor directly to the exterior casing. Instead, it kind of just heats up the, you know, the air cavity inside of the MacBook Air. And that's obviously that's limiting in certain ways, but it doesn't bond the heat directly to the exterior casing. I wonder if they would switch to something like a vapor chamber. What are they moving the heat to? Would it just be like, you know, some other larger piece of metal inside the case?
No, they put it to the case, like just like they do on the phone. Like the whole point is if they had bonded the SoC to the case, it would make one little hot spot, because it's harder for the heat to move through the thick aluminum case. The whole point of a vapor chamber is it moves heat real quick from where it's produced to the outer edges, right? So if you imagined a MacBook Air size vapor chamber, it would solve the problem of the hot spot in the case by not making the heat have to propagate through the relatively thick aluminum of the case and thus forming a really big hot spot that could burn your leg or whatever. It would immediately spread it over a way bigger area, and that would solve the problem. Like, I think that's and I'm not sure they would bond it to the case. They might just have the heat pipe moving it more efficiently to areas where there is cooler air, because you still do build up heat inside the case where the SoC is. But I think they mostly vent. I have to look at the recent teardowns, but I think they're mostly venting the hot air from the MacBook Air out from the, like, the little, like the...
like the keyboard hinge?
The hinge holes?
Yeah, whatever. Yeah.
Like the it comes like that's where the fans blow on the ones that have fans. Without the fans, I think it's venting out there. And back in the day, you remember they used to vent a lot through the keyboard, right?
So you feel heat. They still kind of do, I think.
Yeah, I think they do too, because it's not like they're waterproof. But yeah, any time you can spread heat, I think, and especially since like the MacBook Air is, granted, it can make a hot spot or whatever, but it's not, you know, the amount of heat produced by the MacBook Air is much lower than like an M4 Max and a MacBook Pro. So I think any kind of spreader would make it suddenly viable to bond that to the aluminum.
Hmm. I mean, also keep in mind, like the MacBook Air uses the same chips as the iPad Pro. It's like this rumor of it coming to the iPad Pro.
Yeah.
That would kind of make sense. I mean, yeah, if they can spread it among a big enough area that it wouldn't create enough hotspots. I do wonder, though, there's also another component here of cost. You know, keep in mind, the MacBook Air sells for less than the iPhone Pro. Think about that. Like, the MacBook Air is an entire, you know, much larger screen, much more case, like, much bigger computer, keyboard. Like, the amount of parts in a MacBook Air is substantial compared to a phone. You know, the phone has things like a cell modem that the MacBook Air probably will never have. But
the phone has way better margins, than I believe, than the bottom of the line
right.
MacBook Air does.
So whatever they're doing in a MacBook Air for the processor, they probably do it to all MacBook Airs of that model line. They might not be able to afford the margins for a large vapor chamber.
That's an interesting
I mean, I don't know how much those things cost, but looking at them, they look like they're fairly cheap to manufacture, right? So who knows? Like, it could be that they just don't. I mean, and I kind of agree with them. Like, heat generation and thermal throttling, it happens in the MacBook Air. We know it does, but who cares? Like, that's the machine. Like, the trade-off is you get thermal throttling in exchange for having no fan. And that is a trade-off that a lot of people like and I think is appropriate for the bottom-of-the-line MacBook. If you need to do these massive sustained workloads, don't buy a MacBook Air. But, like, for almost all the people who buy one, they're fine with it. It's fine. The thing's so freaking fast anyway. Like, oh, no, I thermal throttled during some sustained activity. Who cares? It's a $1,000 laptop. It's amazing, right? So it could be that Apple continues to make the calculation and say, yeah, thermal throttles. This is the one that thermal throttles, but are the people who buy this, it doesn't matter to them. It's better to have no fan. I agree with it.
Honestly, I do too. Like, you know, as a frequent MacBook Air owner, I've never cared about thermal throttling. I've never even noticed it in my, including, you know, doing things on it like software development. I've just never noticed it. You know, because I think you might notice it if you're doing like, you know, video encoding every single day.
Yeah, some kind of batch job with a progress bar where you time and you're like, boy, this used to take 20 minutes, but now it's taking 37. You know?
Right. Yeah. But yeah, unless you're really stressing it for like more than a couple of minutes straight regularly, I don't think you would even notice.
All right. Let's talk sports. Marco's favorite thing. We were talking a lot about Apple's MLS deal and F1 deals in overtime last week, and somehow we all lost sight of the fact that the Apple MLS deal is actually worldwide, but it's for the American Major League Soccer thing. I can't think of the word I'm looking for.
League.
Thank you. Gosh.
How did I get
it? Right there. It's right there in L. It's the L in Major League Soccer. I literally just said it. That's okay. Reading from Apple's original newsroom post in June of 2022, the Apple TV app will be the exclusive destination to watch every single live MLS match from 2023 to 2032. Jake Lee also pointed out Apple put up a billboard in Korea for it too. Sun Hwangmin, one of the biggest players in Korea, recently moved to the Los Angeles Football Club, and Apple was marketing that hard here in Korea. And we'll put a link in the show notes to that billboard.
Everyone will point out, having the worldwide rights versus the U.S. rights to MLS are basically the same thing, because nobody else in the world cares about MLS. At least that's what they all tell us.
Well, that is true. All right. John, your shortcuts bug. If you'd like, I can start reading this and you can interject. If you would like to cover it, that's fine. But we had some feedback with regard to this, and this was discussed in last week's after show. How would you like to proceed?
Yeah. So the upshot is I am not the only person who has experienced this bug.
Which, is that an upshot?
Yeah, that's you can read the what's here, but that this is just supporting evidence to say it's not just me.
All right, so we'll start with Callum, who writes, I've been experiencing the same shortcuts bug for about the past year. I have a shortcut that converts a PDF into images and then rearranges the images to create a new PDF. Every month I run it, rename the new PDF in Finder, and upload it to Google Drive. Sometime later, it just disappears, and I have to re-download it from Google Drive. I thought I was going mad. Then FleetR writes, I was using shortcuts to apply color correction to several hundred photos of Pixelmator and ran into your bug with the output photos being completely deleted. I eventually gave up on finding a solution. This was in early 2023, so it's depressing to know that it hasn't been fixed. Lucan77 on Reddit back in 2024, which was pointed out to us via Euro00, writes, I have a few shortcuts that create files, but these files seem to keep disappearing. I've not yet been able to identify any kind of pattern to this, such as whether it happens after X occurrences or after Y minutes. When they disappear, it seems all files created by any of the shortcuts all disappear. I've not yet managed to ascertain if this happens at the same time. Then Gleeful chips in, disabling the overwrite flag is a workaround that worked for me. So there's an image which we'll put in the show notes. The shortcut action is save resized image to get parent directory. And some of the options are ask where to save, subpath, and overwrite file or overwrite if file exists. And disabling that apparently is the trick.
Yeah. So I tried that because this is a screenshot from my actual shortcut. I did have override a file exists checked because that's what I wanted. But in practice, it's usually not overwriting a file. Unchecking that box makes it so the files do not disappear. In fact, I just did one last experiment before the show started. Let me check. Yep, that does it. So that tells me a lot. That tells me this is a shortcuts bug. Shortcuts is the one doing it. Because when I uncheck that checkbox in shortcuts, which makes no functional difference if I'm generating the files and there's no conflicting file. Like, functionally, it shouldn't make a difference, but it is clearly shortcuts deleting it. Lots of people are suggesting that I use fsusage or lsof or some other thing to find out which process is deleting the files. It's some shortcuts-related thing. Like, it surely is, because every other way I do this, including, by the way, I made a shortcut that just runs a shell script, those files don't get deleted either. It is specifically this save files in directory shortcut action with the overwrite file if it exists option makes the files get written there, stay there for some period of time, and then later it deletes them. It's the only thing that, you know, and again, when if you just have it run a shell script, and the shell script runs like the SIPs command line tool that does image processing stuff that's built into that's concluded with macOS, that works fine. So I would say this mystery is essentially solved. This is a shortcuts bug. Apparently, it's been there since 2023. Lots of other people have experienced it. The workaround is uncheck the override if file exists checkbox and the save file things. But boy, what a bug. And the fact that multiple people have seen it and it still hasn't been fixed is kind of depressing.
Not great, Bob. All right, let's talk about the iconic plateau. Gordon McDowell writes, the iPhone only needs a protrusion sticking out as far as the camera on the opposite side to eliminate wobble. It could be another bloody camera. It could be one of the existing cameras moved there.
Yeah, this was about me saying, like, people who are saying they should make the plateau the same, like, thickness as the camera thing, and that would be too much. And you're like, well, you don't have to make the whole plateau thick, just put the camera on the other side. Lots of other phones do this. They have lines of cameras that aren't in kind of like a three-dot cluster on one side, like, because Apple evolved from their notion that the cameras were in the corner, and they slowly expanded out from the corner until they were more than half the width of the phone, but they were still clustered as if they were in the corner, but they weren't, and that led to the wobble. So yeah, Apple could have done kind of a bug eye thing, or a two-in-one thing, or spread the three out. There's lots of things they could have done to make their phones not wobble, but apparently that is not an important design consideration, at least thus far on their phone. And it's not like they don't want to look like they're imitating the other phones that do that. They directly copied the Google Pixels like like thing on the back with the iPhone Air. So I don't know what they're afraid of. I still think they need to reconsider the camera arrangement. But yeah, I mean, hell, they don't need to make a camera. They just have to put a nub over there. Like Spurs said, just put some kind of like little nub or kickstand or ridge or who knows. Like, I guess people don't care about their phones wobbling because I guess they're holding them most of the time instead of putting them on the table. But
well, and also, like, most phone cases will just put a huge lip around the camera bump and level it out anyway. So, like, most people use cases on their phones. And most phone cases remove this problem from being a problem.
I don't think
anymore.
Most phone cases do remove it. Look at the bull strap case. That doesn't remove the problem. Like, the bump is so big now that it doesn't, it's impossible to level out with any reasonable case. Even the bull strap case doesn't do it, and they cover the other part of the non-camera part of the plateau on the Pro phones.
I don't know. The cheap clear case I got and the Peak Design case both level it out. It just has to be
bull strap leather ones don't.
Yeah.
Anyway, Apple could solve this problem, but so far they haven't.
All right, so from the HP Insider episode on the restaurant season one, we fairly briefly made mention of the Cheesecake Factory, and I think one of us, John, had said, it was Marco. See, it's always...
We were telling Marco about how fantastically huge the Cheesecake Factory menu is, because for some miraculous reason, Marco has never been to the Cheesecake Factory, and we recommend that he goes just to see the menu, because it is so huge. Now that he's a restaurant owner, he can appreciate what it must take to have a menu this big. And Marco said, well, surely a lot of the stuff is frozen. And I agreed. It's like, it's got to be frozen. Like, there's no way you can have all this stuff available and not have stuff, you know, frozen.
Yeah. So we found, I don't know who pointed this out, I'm sorry, but somebody pointed to the Daily Meal website, which reads, despite the fact that a long menu is usually a red flag, the food is at a restaurant is pre-made and reheated. The opposite is the case with the Cheesecake Factory. All 250 menu items or more are made from scratch every day with fresh ingredients. But the same can't be said for the cheesecakes. All the cheesecakes are delivered to the restaurant frozen, then defrosted before serving to customers.
There's no name associated with this because a lot of people sent this in. There's a lot of Cheesecake Factory fans out there who wanted to defend the honor of the Cheesecake Factory and say, no, it's not frozen.
And how excellent is it that a place called the Cheesecake Factory has all fresh food except the cheesecakes, which are made at a factory?
Well, so if you go through the history of the thing, it started with somebody who was making cheesecakes in their basement, and then she was making the cheesecakes for the restaurant until it became like untenable for her to do it. But anyway, frozen or not, the cheesecake at the Cheesecake Factory is good. If you like cheesecake, they make good cheesecake. So I'm not going to besmirch the frozen cheesecake. I don't care if it's frozen. It tastes pretty good.
I will still insist the cheesecake is pie.
I'd have to consult the cube rule, and I don't have it in front of me, and I'm not going to do that right this second. All right, let's talk topics, and we have a smorgasbord of Mac rumors to talk about, starting with the M6 or OLED MacBook Pro. So we can read from Bloomberg. Let's see. The company is readying a revamped MacBook Pro with a touch display for late 2026 or early 2027. The new laptops will feature OLED displays and will retain a full trackpad and keyboard. The new machine's codename K114, K116 will also have thinner and lighter frames and run the M6 line of chips. For the revamped MacBook Pro, Apple's retiring the notch. In its place, the company will adopt a so-called hole punch design. This will be similar in concept to the dynamic island on the phone. The company has also developed a reinforced hinge in screen hardware to prevent the display from bouncing back or moving when touched, a common drawback of the existing touch PCs. Because of the pricier components, the new 14 and 16-inch MacBook Pros are likely to cost a few $100 more than the current versions. As of now, Apple isn't actively developing additional touchscreen Macs. Instead, it's waiting to see the market's reaction to the touch version of the MacBook Pro. Earlier, Mark Gurman had written in a different article, Apple is investigating the idea of bringing cellular connectivity to the Mac. Oh, hell yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Cellular connections are unlikely to come to the Mac before 2026 when Apple's planning a second generation modem that includes support for faster speeds.
So this is a lot of existing OLED MacBook Pro rumors. Like, again, the MacBook Pro, OLED MacBook Pro was originally rumored for this year. Then they said it actually is going to be pushed to next year. So the rumors continue to say next year is the OLED year. When we were talking about the M5 MacBook Pro, just the plain M5 one, I was saying this generation of M5 MacBook Pros will probably be your last chance to get this design because the new design is coming. And it looks like the new design is going to be different in many, many ways. Being thinner, maybe, you know, do you like the current trade-off in terms of size, weight, and battery life? Will the thinner ones be better because of better battery chemistry? We don't know, but like if you want a known quantity, the known quantity of the size, weight, and battery life of these ones, it is here for you. Touchscreen. This is the first time this has been rumored, like in a substantial from like Gurman, who usually doesn't just make stuff up, right? Lots of people have been talking about touch Macs for ages and ages. This is a Gurman rumor, and it's corroborated by at least one other person. So it seems like they're going to do this. They're finally going to bring touchscreen to a Mac. That involves a new hinge to make it so the display doesn't wobble as much. There's also the cell modem rumors, which again, the C2 in 2026, 2027, which is when they're supposed to be coming out. And of course, the OLED screen, which is these are the OLED MacBook Pros. So it's going to be a big change. This is the biggest change since the Apple, since these new, it's not the Apple Silicon ones, because the first Apple Silicon ones look like the Intel ones. But since whatever we're calling this new design, the kind of boxy ones that we've had for the, well, I guess M2 through M5, this will be the end of the line, seems like, for that design, and the beginning of an all-new design with a lot of different potential trade-offs. And I'm not saying you should buy these because the new ones are going to be bad. Maybe the new ones are going to be great, and you should wait. All I'm saying is it's going to be a change. And I find this fascinating because we've been waiting for Touch Macs for ages, not because we're dying for them. We're dying for a cell modem Mac. But for Touch Macs, we're like, you know, people want it. Why shouldn't you do it? It shouldn't be that hard. There was another rumor I didn't put in here of like the exact technology they're using to put the touch sensitive thing in the OLED display. It's some new tech that embeds the touch layer inside the OLED so it's not as thick and yada yada, whatever. There's no rumors about software related to the touch thing, but, and I'm not predicting they should do this. I'm not recommending it, but I think if they simply added touch to macOS as it exists today, be fine. Like, yeah. It's not ideal. It's going to come with the trackpad. You should use the trackpad. But how many times have you seen somebody who's accustomed to touch using a laptop and they just want to scroll a web page and they reach out and do it? Or a dialogue comes up and it's just easier for them to just stab the OK button with their finger instead of hit the thing? It's a thing that people do and that it's perfectly possible to do with macOS. macOS is not made for your finger. It's made for the pointer. But there are things that your finger can do on existing macOS. So I don't think Apple needs to say, oh, everything has to become Fisher-Price huge and everything has to be usable by a finger. I don't think they need to do that. I don't think they should do that because that's called an iPad. Right, leave the Mac the way it is. But I think a touchscreen would be a useful addition for the people who want fingerprints all over their laptop screen.
Yeah, and the reality is, like, this is one of those areas that, like, no matter what we as like traditional Mac and laptop nerds think is right, like, you know, I don't want a touchscreen on my MacBook Pro. However, how many people among us can say we've never unthinkingly just touched our laptop screen thinking it would scroll?
Yep.
Like, that's madness. I would never do that. But I will say that I have literally pinched to zoom paper, print paper, more than once.
Yeah.
More than once. Multiple, many times over my life, I have literally put two fingers down on like a magazine page and pinched to make the text bigger. So I'm not above doing that. I just say I haven't done it with the laptop screen. But yeah. Stab that OK button with your finger.
Yeah, and even if all it is scrolling and zooming, that would go a long way. Because like the reality is, again, no matter what we think as nerds, this is what people are used to with every other device. Every Windows PC of any, you know, note has had a touchscreen, or at least had a touchscreen option, for many years now.
Yeah, and they added it because like the PC ecosystem is so diverse, someone's going to try everything. And once somebody tried it, and they're like, people didn't object to it. And second of all, once it becomes like a thing that you have, and you know, your competitor has, but you don't, you're like, well, maybe we should add that too. And people just got used to it being there. Now, was Windows redesigned to be a touch interface? Hell no.
No, but Windows still, is design optimized for nothing. But
right, but like
it's fine.
The PC manufacturers didn't have to like this. Like, well, we can't put touch on our laptops until Windows is radically redesigned so that everything is accessible with your fingertip. Nope, they didn't do that. They just made they just put touchscreens on it, and people started using them. And it's like the market has decided that this is a desirable enough feature to justify what I assume is the fairly minimal cost for the touch layer to be added to the screens of laptops.
Yeah, and the reality is, like, most people out there in the world, especially as you go younger or more novice, most people assume that every screen is a touchscreen, and they will try to touch it. And if it doesn't work like a touchscreen, they're going to either think it's broken, or they're going to think it's not as good as things that are touchscreens. So you have huge market pressure to do it. And, you know, it's one of those cases where we, I think, have talked a lot about, like, you know, purity and like what John was just saying, like waiting until we can redesign everything to do it right, which would be a terrible idea for macOS. But, you know, like waiting till the perfection is possible. And this is a thing that Apple and us, but, you know, Apple often gets stuck in this kind of thinking of, you know, they can't just pinch their nose and do something imperfect. They wait until they can do something perfectly, and in the meantime, they don't address it at all or have something horribly broken, you know, like the because the perfect is the enemy of the good. And sometimes they compromise on their perfect pure vision. For instance, slowly turning the iPad Pro into a laptop, which is what they have done. Like, the iPad, the iPad originally was like, you pretty much only were intended to use it in portrait orientation unless you were watching some video, then you could rotate it. And remember the first keyboard for the iPad that came out with the iPad 1? That was portrait. It was a stand with portrait.
Sure was.
And then everyone was like, hey, you know, this thing actually can work if you just turn it to its side and put a bigger keyboard on the bottom. And then eventually Apple made the iPad Pro and made their own keyboard that held it to the side. But still the camera was on the wrong side and the logo was on the wrong side. And they were insisting this is an everything device, but mainly a portrait device. And it's definitely not a laptop. And then slowly what they've done with the iPad is turn it into a laptop. They gave you landscape uses. They gave you landscape cases with keyboards. They added a trackpad and a pointer. Now they have resizable windows and, like, the Finder kind of, sort of, and they have the dock kind of, sort of. Like, they've turned it into a laptop. All of this was in complete violation of their pure idea, the pure design, the pure ethos. But it's what customers wanted, and it made the product generally better for everyone. Because either you didn't have to use that stuff, and you could keep using it the way you always were, or you could use it the way you actually wanted to, like more of a laptop. And it turns out the iPad is a pretty good laptop for a lot of people. And so I think thinking about touch on the Mac, we should think about it the same way. The Mac is not going to be a great touchscreen device. Probably ever. Just the same way that Windows PCs aren't great touchscreen devices. But a lot of people want that and are assuming that will be there and are disappointed when it's not there, or they have bad experiences because it's not there and they try it and it fails. And so even though we don't want fingerprints all over our screens, similarly to how many iPad users don't want or use any of the multitasking features and never connect the keyboard to their iPads, there are so many people who want their MacBook Pros or their MacBooks to have touchscreens and assume they will and have bad experiences because they don't, that it should be there. It has reached the point of popularity and user pressure now that they should have touchscreens.
And I mean, it reached that point a while ago.
But. Yes. And the rest of us who don't want fingerprints all over our screens don't have to use it.
Yeah, and I think when Apple executives have always talked about this, even back when Steve Jobs was still alive, I think he said similar things like, oh, your arm gets tired, having your arm up, touching a Mac, touch Macs are no good. But obviously with laptops, especially if you're literally using them on your lap, the screen isn't out in front of your eye line like an ergonomically correct desktop display. It's down. It's where an iPad screen would be if the iPad was in laptop floppy laptop mode, or if the iPad is just up on a stand. It's lower, it's tilted, and it is more viable, and I'm assuming that's what they'll say. It's like, we've always said your arms will get tired, but with a laptop, you don't have to hold your arm up. It's down there, and I don't know how they'll spin it, but it's like, all I'm saying is that I think that this doesn't mean that, like, the new Apple display, which they'll come out with someday, I swear, will be a touchscreen. Because look, in the PC world, there's not a huge number of desktop displays that are touch displays. Because it is tiring to have your finger up like that. Now, I'm sure there are some, and especially if you have like a drafting table style touch PC, that's a different ball of wax, but Apple has never really made one of those. They still could, but they haven't. Although if they made one of those, it should probably run iPad OS or something. But like, if they do, what I'm saying is, if they do this with laptops, I would imagine, as the article says, although God knows how he could possibly know this, like, oh, they're gonna do it on the laptops and then just wait and see. And if people like it, maybe they'll expand it out or whatever. But yeah, laptops first makes perfect sense for putting the touch on things. And again, it will be fun to see how they market this.
All right, a few other quick grab bag items. The other new Macs in development include updated MacBook Airs with the M5 chip. These devices are slated for release in the spring. Apple's also working on a refreshed Mac Studio, Mac Mini, and a pair of external Mac monitors dubbed J427 and 527.
Sure they are.
You'll notice that... I have not yet mentioned the Mac Pro. Apple is exploring another major Mac change as well, a shift from the Touch ID fingerprint scanner to Face ID, but that remains years away.
Years away. Oh my God, put Face ID on Macs. You know where you could experiment with that first? Put it on the laptops. It's killing me that they don't put, like,
yep.
And the thing is, laptops is the place where they have an excuse, like all the displays to send. They're going to come out with new displays, these long-rumored, like, Pro Display XDR successor and presumably a Studio Display successor with a 19 Pro and whatever. There's so much room in those displays for a Face ID sensor. They're so freaking thick. Put Face ID on the Mac. Stop. What are you waiting for? It's killing me. I mean, I know you guys are waiting for cellular, but Face ID on the Mac is just, it's just brutal. I don't know what they're waiting for. Like, it's just... gather up those only put it on your own displays. It's another reason for people to buy your displays. You don't even have to like have it be third party displayed. Only put it on your first party displays. Anyway, yeah. Originally, when I put this in here, it was like this German article was like other Macs in development: MacBook Air, Mac Studio, Mac Mini. Just not even a mention of the Mac Pro from German. But then, Brendan Shanks to the rescue.
Brendan Shanks writes: new in Xcode 26.1 beta 3. This is a constant CPU family underscore ARM underscore Hydra, HIDRA, which is listed as H17G.
We discussed that, which is apparently an island. Where is the island? I forget. Is it in like
I remember the discussion.
Scandinavia or something.
Yeah, somewhere up there, yeah.
Yeah, it's not the multi-headed beast of Greek myth, which is HYDRA. Anyway, this was supposedly the code name for a Apple Silicon chip that has not been released that is potentially a large, beefy chip that would be suitable for a Mac Pro, even though German's not even mentioning that. It's like, oh, here's the Mac rumors for the next year. They're going to update these Macs and those Macs and those. Not even a mention of the Mac Pro. Not even like no news on the Mac Pro or Mac Pro, you know, like just nothing. Just doesn't even get mentioned, like it doesn't exist. Maybe the product is canceled. But then in the new beta of Xcode, a constant sneaks through that mentions the rumored code name of a chip that, as far as we know, has not shipped, is not one of the M5 chips slated for the MacBook Pros. It could be a Mac Pro chip, or it could just be the beefy chip that they ship in the next Mac Studio, and the Mac Pro really is dead. Who knows what will happen, but here I am out here trying to sell those Mac Pro Believe shirts, wearing mine in my heart every day.
Incredible. All right, let's do a hello, future Marco. I think we still got time. Do we want to do Liquid Glass? I think it's fine. Yeah. Unless you wanted to emphasize Ask ATP, which I know we haven't done in a long time, but I'm fine to do.
We have, because of scheduling things, in a couple of weeks we're gonna have a show that might be Ask ATP heavy, so don't worry about saving.
Okay. All right, goodbye, future Marco.
Bye.
All right, let's talk some new developments or new-ish developments in the OS's 26 in the beta 4. In beta 4 for iOS 26, you can now tone down Liquid Glass. And I saw a lot of news articles about this, and they all frustrated me that they didn't have side-by-side comparisons, or at least not when I first started reading about it. But our dear friend Stephen Hackett did yeoman's work to put these together, and so we'll put a link to Stephen's excellent post in the show notes. You go into, for iPad OS and iOS, you go into settings and then display and brightness. For Mac OS, you go into system settings, appearance, and there you'll find a new toggle that lets you swap between two looks, clear and tinted. Clear is the look of Liquid Glass since iOS 26 launched, while tinted adds opacity and contrast.
So I know that the names they put in the UI aren't necessarily connected to the names that of the APIs behind the scenes, but it was, I initially saw this and I was wondering if this is the same as the API, at least on macOS. When you make a glass material thing, you have a choice between clear and tinted. Like those are like the constant numbers or whatever, dot clear or dot tinted. And when you do glass that's tinted, you can also specify the tint color. So like if you have switch glass, my little app switcher thing that looks like the dock, it has like a background or whatever, and it has materials you can pick for the background. And I use all the deprecated constants that Apple doesn't want me to use for the different backgrounds. Anyway, in Tahoe, you can pick glass, and you can pick clear glass, or you can pick tinted glass. And then when you pick tinted glass, you can pick the color. So I wonder if the tinted look is literally, they just change all the things that are, when they see the dot clear constant, they just use the dot tinted one, and they pick a fixed tint color. It's hard to say, because just because the name matches doesn't mean it's the same thing. But anyway, it seems like it might not even be new code, and it's just simply like, oh, when they do dot clear, ignore that, and really just use dot tinted with white as the background with some opacity level.
All right, and then below these selections, there's little teeny tiny gray text, because of course it's gray, that reads, choose your preferred look for Liquid Glass. Clear is more transparent, revealing the content beneath. Tinted increases opacity and adds more contrast. And speaking of yeoman's work, John has done us a service, and we'll put a link in the show notes to some examples of tinted versus untinted. John, do you want to talk these through?
Yeah, so Stephen Hackett's got a lot of before and afters. Lots of other people on the web since then have had a bunch of before and afters. And I picked some from, this is actually running the beta, and I took some screenshots of it. And by the way, the RC is out there. Release Canada is out now, so this is a little bit old news, but I don't think it's changed. But side by side, depending on the context, I don't see that much of a difference between the regular and the new setting, you know, between clear and tinted. You can see the background through both. It's not like reduced transparency where it makes it totally opaque. Like I was just in a messages thread. That's what you'll see is like part of messages, and it shows like a photo, you know, like it's a white background with non-white photos, and the non-white photos clearly show through the tinted version. They show through more in the clear one, but there's still like, if you're going to make this setting, it seems so subtle. It seems like it's a little bit more opaque. Is that better? Just like, if people don't want to see stuff that is behind their controls, don't make them go all the way to reduce transparency. And if this really is tinted, as I said, like the actual tinted control, let people pick the opacity and the color. Put it like a, you know, or put an opacity slider underneath it, because it would be, you know, when you do tinted, you can pick the color and you can put an alpha channel on that cover. Like, I don't know. It's clear that they decided to do this because people thought it was too transparent. But boy, you give a setting like, I'm going to be hesitant to even tell this to like my kids, because they complain a little bit about liquid glass stuff. They're going to be like, what difference does that make? It's the same. I'm like, well, it's actually a little bit more opaque. See, if you could see them side by side, you'd notice that. Yeah, I guess if you see them side by side, you would notice, but I don't know. Like, it seems half-hearted to me, I guess.
I can tell you, so as soon as the setting was released in the beta, as I switched to it from my iPhone, and then at some point later, I didn't realize that there was also the option on the Mac, and so then like on my laptop that runs Tahoe, at some point, like a few days after using it on the phone full-time, I saw a notification show up in Tahoe with the ridiculous, overly glassy look, and it was immediately, I was like, ugh! Like, it jumped out at me so much.
Well, here's the problem. On beta 4, changing that setting doesn't affect notifications.
Oh, great.
Like, I tried when I was trying to do the screenshots. Yeah, I know. But when I was trying to do the screenshots, I'm like, I know, I'll do notifications, because those are so clear, they annoy me. So I turned the setting on, got a notification, it didn't change. It looks exactly the same. Now, maybe that was a beta 4 bug, and maybe in the RC it does change, but that's what I'm saying about it being half-hearted. On macOS, it doesn't even look like it's applying the setting to lots of places where you wish it would be applied, like notifications. Again, this is beta 4 knowledge. I haven't installed the RCs yet, but it seems a little half-hearted to me. And hopefully macOS will eventually apply it everywhere. But yeah, maybe it looks a little bit better in iOS. But yeah, reduced transparency really does reduce transparency, but it radically changes how things look, and I think it makes things look even uglier. So that setting is always there for you in accessibility, but this is pointedly not in accessibility. It's in, you know, settings appearance or settings display and brightness, which is a weird place for it to be. I guess there's no appearance equivalent in iOS settings. And anyway, when 26.1 comes out, this will be a setting, and if liquid glass is annoying you, you can give it a try.
I can say also, again, like on the phone, having used this now for what it has, long has been, like 2 weeks, I can say it's great. It has been going great, and it is generally better. Liquid glass is not perfect with it, but I can say, like, after switching to this and then seeing, you know, the glassy version on macOS, it instantly made the regular version of liquid glass look garish and tacky and already old. Like, liquid glass has been out for 2 seconds, and it already, once you see something a little bit more toned down, it makes the shipping version look really old.
It always looked tacky to me. And I think you can check this too, but I think even on iOS, you know, like the play pause controls that hover over playing video, like in a pop-up window?
The ones that directly get in the way of your content that it's trying to spotlight? Yes. Yeah.
I don't think those honor the setting either. I think they look exactly the same with the setting on or off.
Well, those were different. So that's the clear style.
That's clear. Like, I know, but that's what I'm saying. But like, it seems weird to me. Like, those are the most egregious. Those are so, because the content behind them is always, you know, it's guaranteed to be something, you know, uncontrolled because it's video. And those are the glassiest of the glassiest things for controls that I don't need to be glassy. Like, I think they're too big and obtrusive as it is. I don't want them to have specular highlights and be warping and refracting things and all that crap. So I wish the setting applied to them, even if it only applied a little bit. It's so weird to me that you would put the setting in and say, yeah, but the clearest controls, those are accepted from this.
Maybe, but to be fair, like, that was, those kind of controls the ones like the playback over the video, those were always a more clear version than the default.
Yeah, that's those not are the actual look. Dot clear.
Yeah, exactly.
Those are like that's what I'm saying. The constant. It's confusing that they're using the same language as the constants because the settings here are clear and tinted, but there's clear and tinted glass in the OS, and this clear tinted setting only seems to apply to the not clear API, you know, yeah. constants. It's confusing.
Yeah, and I think and you know, kind of broader picture, I think the fact that they had to add this so soon shows that they're getting a lot of pushback and people are having a lot of problems with Liquid Glass. And ultimately, there's a lot about the Liquid Glass design language that I don't think is good. There are some things that I think are nice. It's going to need a lot of tweaks. It's going to need a lot of adjustments. I think generally speaking, we will get to a place with it, with a bit more iteration, where it is actually pretty nice. But it's going to need a lot. It's going to need, you know, work and time. And the fact that they're already fixing it, number one, you can say, like, wow, lol, what a failure that they had to fix it so soon, which is valid. But at least they are fixing it. At least we are going in a direction where they're toning this down so quickly because maybe they got enough pushback that it needs the work that it needs. So that's promising, at least to me. And I think we will look back, you know, similarly to how when iOS 7 was first unveiled at its WWDC, the fonts were these like super thin, like ultra light Helvetica. And over the course of the beta that summer, they iterated the design of iOS 7 to be less egregiously thin so that you could actually read text anywhere in the OS. That's happening to Liquid Glass. It just didn't finish during the beta. But I think we're seeing that process now in the point releases that, the most egregious versions of this are being tweaked now. Yes, it should have happened in July. It didn't, but at least it's happening now instead of having to wait till next summer.
Well, it kind of happened in the betas. Do you remember there was, I forget which beta it was, maybe beta 3 or something?
Where yeah, it added basically
super,
this.
Super frosty.
Yeah.
Right? And I think, someone should dig up these screenshots, but I think it was the beta 3 version of this showed less stuff through controls than this new version does with the tinted setting turned on. So it's not like they turned it on and then there was some outcry from developers we talked about on the show, like, oh, you said it was called with a liquid glass, but now I can barely see through the controls. It doesn't look like glass anymore. And so like during the beta, it went really, really opaque. And then it went back to be more transparent. And the more transparent one is the one they released. Maybe not as transparent as the very first beta, but certainly more. It was not the most opaque of the betas, right? And then after release, now they're adding a setting to make it slightly more opaque. I haven't seen a lot of outcry about this, but we're all kind of sitting here waiting for when Apple starts forcing this update on people, which I'm assuming will happen 26.1. Is that when they usually do it?
Usually.
Like, and what we mean by that is, like, lots of people were surprised about it. They're always surprised about this every year. Like, the new OS comes out, and they're like, I went to system settings on my phone to get the new OS, and can you believe it was trying to tell me, like, there's a new version of iOS 18? You have to scroll down, and it's like, oh, and by the way, there's also a thing called 26. Do you want that one? But the top one on the phone was 18. They don't sort of, like, shove 26 in your face, at least on the phone, until the 0.1 release. And then people's phones are going to, like, it's going to prompt them. It's going to be in system settings. It's going to be a badge. It's going to auto-update overnight. Like, all sorts of, like, when they really push this out to the general public. And it's a good move because 26.0 was a mess, and you don't want to push that out to everybody. 26.1 will be better. I will note that on the Mac, the day macOS 26 came out, system settings got a badge, and it's still there, and I can't make it go away. It's like, you know 26 is out. I'm like, I know.
I don't have one.
I do. It's been there since the day macOS 26 was launched. Software update available. Badge with a 1 in it. Cannot make it go away no matter what I do. Because there is one. If I go to system settings, it says, hey, Tahoe's available. Do you want it? Not only that, but every 15 update, like 15.7.1, if you weren't careful, like if you have auto updates off and you go to manually install it, if you weren't careful and you tried to install Sequoia, it would install 26. If you didn't go in and like uncheck the 26 checkbox, it's been pushing 26 so hard on the Mac. I'm like, Apple, you don't want to do this. I mean, it doesn't really matter because there's so few Mac users and we're more technically savvy than the average phone user, I suppose, and blah, blah, blah. But yeah, on the phone, they hold back. So I'm still kind of waiting for 26 to get pushed to quote-unquote everyone to finally decide what the public reaction to it is. But I feel like the public reaction to 26 as it exists right now has been people aren't super big fans of it, but I haven't seen any you know, complaining on the level of like the new Photos app. And we'll see. I don't remember. Did the new Photos app complaining only start after they pushed 18.1 to everybody? Or did it happen with 18.0?
Yes, it was both.
Well, we'll see when they push it to everybody. But right now, even my kids who are like, who refused to use a Mac that had Tahoe on it, they've got it on their new phones and they grumbled a little bit. But otherwise, they're like, eh, it's fine.
And I think we're going to see, like, what has happened throughout the course of computer interface history whenever anyone has used transparency because it looks cool. What happens over time? They make it less transparent because transparent UIs don't work very well. And that's happening here. We are going to see this progression. It will end up somewhere that is reasonably fine. And the translucency is not Liquid Glass's only problem. But this is probably its biggest. And so
unfortunately for Liquid Glass, it's in the name, the glass part of it. And you mentioned like, oh, we'll eventually find a happy medium. Like, the correct move is not to show things through controls, especially controls that have text on them, because it doesn't serve a functional purpose. It's only there for aesthetics and it only hurts your legibility. So it's like, why are you doing this yourself? Why are you choosing this? It's like, well, don't you understand? It's glass. Okay, if that's your controlling metaphor and your aesthetic and your marketing, then you're kind of stuck with showing stuff through, because glass doesn't show anything through. Really, is like opaque glass. Like, I guess it could be shiny on the edges, but people think of glass as being able to see something through it. That's just a fundamentally wrong-headed idea. Nothing behind that button needs to contribute to the content of that button. To the extent that you show it through the button, it can only make the button more misleading and obscure. So the correct amount of transparency in a button, if there is content behind it, is zero. And they're like, well, but what if we, how close can we get? We don't want to do zero, because doesn't, can we, and yeah, they'll probably find something that is like, makes people, it's like, all right, it's fine. But it's a fundamentally wrongheaded idea. I also think the floating controls off the edge is a fundamentally wrongheaded idea in terms of efficiency and space usage, especially on the phone, but that is a separate issue. But yeah, that's kind of the problem with this. Whereas the fonts, like, well, we can just make the fonts thicker, done and done. But this is like one of our basic ideas. You know, like I said, it's the floating the controls off the edge, showing things through the content, and whatever third one that I can never remember.
The touch targets are too small. Everything has no contrast around it. I mean,
there's some pre-existing problems, but it's kind of hard to have a thing styled on glass where you don't have it show stuff to. But they don't put content behind buttons, and if you do put it there through behind buttons, don't make the button show the content through. Don't make the text field show the content through. Like, where I'm still seeing screenshots, granted, from the nerds that are in my circles on like Mastodon, of like, look at this scrolling text region that is fading up behind some header text, making the header text completely illegible because right behind it, offset by one pixel, is other text. And it's just, it looks like an error. And like, this is the UI that you want? Like, that whole fade thing where text scrolls behind text with a gradient fade? That's a bad idea. You can never make that work. You have to stop doing that and use the hard edge scrolling thing like in iOS 18 and all the ones before. There's no amount of fading and adjusting of contrast or whatever that will ever make that a good idea. It is just a bad idea. And so we just have to live with it until somebody wakes up and says, you know that thing where we put text behind text? Let's not do that anymore.
Then one more quick item. There's now an option to disable the lock screen swipe to get to the camera. This is in settings camera, lock screen swipe to open camera. I didn't know this was a thing that people hated, but I guess this is a thing that people hated.
It's accidental input. It's not that people hate it. If you use it, it's great to have it. But if you never use it intentionally, but only ever accidentally use it, that's the thing. What they need is some kind of, I don't know how to implement this, but what they need is butt dial protection, because my parents butt dial me all the time and there is no explanation. Like, the best I can come up with is they don't sleep their phone before they put it in their pocket. Right?
Oh, yeah.
They don't sleep their phone.
I do that sometimes.
Or they do sleep their phone, like they press the sleep wake button, but their phone is like bogged down or slow or something, and it doesn't go to sleep until they've begun putting it in their pocket. But the bottom line is somehow their hands are touching the screen and activating stuff that's causing them to call me, and I get a call from inside of their pocket, and I can hear them talking. I say, Dad, butt dial me. He usually can't hear me. I just hang out. But like, and I've been with him when this has happened. I'm like, what did you just do? Tell me. And he can't explain it. But there is some kind of accidental input user interface thing going on here. Again, my leading theory is they just are simply not sleeping the phone. But like, so all right. So say they don't sleep the phone. How do you accidentally I'm probably in their favorites or maybe in their recents. Like, but how do you accidentally initiate a call to me by accidentally rubbing your fingers? Slide to go to the camera, I can see happening, because that's just a pretty simple move. You just slide sideways. But anyway, lots of accidental input happening. I'm glad to see this setting. I'm sure it will still be on by default, but if you find yourself accidentally going to the camera when you don't want to and you never use the shortcut, now you can turn it off.
All right, I have a question for you. Is Tahoe safe to run yet? Because I am not currently running Tahoe, and I've seen a medium amount of chatter, particularly around one in particular bug that we'll discuss in a minute. But I've been reluctant to upgrade, which is not unusual these days, but I used to be like a day one person for everything. So what's the deal? Are you two running Tahoe? Do you recommend it? Do you recommend me holding off? Where do we go from here? Let me start with Marco.
I am running it on my small travel laptop. I am not running it on my main, like, you know, main laptop, my desktop laptop. And so far, like, as I'm using it on my little laptop, and then I go back and forth between my desktop and my laptop, I'm not motivated to upgrade my desktop to Tahoe. So, like, when I'm not using Tahoe, I don't miss it. There's no feature I miss. There's nothing about it that's motivating me that I should update my desktop, except that eventually Sequoia will stop getting updates meaningfully from Apple. But right now, like, there is no motivating reason for me to do it. Now, also, when I am on Tahoe on my laptop, I don't care. Besides my stupid glassy notifications, like, it's fine. Everything looks different. Everything's lower contrast. I don't think liquid glass holds up well at all on the Mac, especially the treatment of toolbars and sidebars. I think it looks ridiculous. The corners of everything are really massive, like the rounded corners, massive corners. So there's a lot of, like, little noises with it. But, like, whenever I'm on either computer, I'm never wishing that it was the OS of the other one. And I'm never looking at it and saying, wow, I love this OS. Like, it's fine. Everything looks different. Yeah, it's a different skin on the OS. Things work fine. I don't have many major problems with either one, to be honest. But again, like, it's not motivating a change in either direction. That being said, something's up with my tethering setup on my phone. I don't know. Again, it's 26.1 on both, and I have the 26.1 beta on the Mac, and I have the 26.1 beta on the phone. It's an iPhone 17 Pro. Cellular and tethering have been really unreliable, to the point where I'm frequently having to reboot the iPhone to get cellular data to keep working. Now, I don't know if that's and that's oftentimes happening when I'm tethering with a laptop. So I don't know if tethering is somehow I don't know if it's like a Tahoe bug that's breaking the phone's cell connection, or if the phone has a broken tethering implementation. This is also all to say that that was all only with the betas of 26.1. The RC came out, I think, what, today or yesterday? And I've only just installed the RC, like, tonight. So I don't know if this is fixed in the RC, but I honestly, it's been so bad in the betas, I don't know how it would be. I don't know how it would be fixed. But something is really broken with cellular data or tethering or both with 26.1 on an iPhone 17 Pro. And I don't know if that's it's related to the way Tahoe's using it from the Mac or not. I don't know. But tethering and data are super broken for me. And it could even be like my phone could be bad. It's that bad, to the point where I cannot get through a train ride without having to reboot my phone for tethering connectivity. Anyway, all that being said, Tahoe in general, again, it's been fine. The design is stupid on the Mac, but it's been fine. If you need to upgrade for some motivating reason, go for it. If you don't have such a motivating reason, I don't see any reason why you would need to rush it.
Fair enough. What about you, John?
Is Tahoe safe? 26.0? No, not safe. I rarely say that about the 0.0 releases. I usually update them as soon as possible, although that's been moderated in my podcast in years by whether or not the Rogue Amoeba, like Audio Hijack stuff, is updated or whatever. But 26.0, I've read about too many problems with that. Now, 26.1 is going to be out soon, so maybe this will change with 26.1. I've been running the betas, but 26.0 just has so many problems I've heard about, not just like little things like, well, I don't use tethering, but like fundamental sort of OS-wide slowdowns that people don't have good explanations for. And we're going to get into one possible popular culprit here in a second. But I'm not saying don't upgrade because it's ugly, and it is, or because of the UI, just because it seems buggier than usual. And there's one particular, there's one known particular bug that may affect a lot of people, and there's no real workaround for it. Dan Morin has been chasing this for a while because he thought it was the bug we're going to talk about, but he's like, now I'm pretty sure it's not that bug, and it's still happening to me. Lots of people complaining about slowdowns. And I know it's like, oh, Liquid Glass is doing more effects and whatever, but those effects are very well accelerated, and maybe it'll use, like, someone tried to do a battery test recently. Like, I'm going to use, like, Liquid Glass versus, like, I think with the setting on and off to see if, like, one uses more power than the other. You could probably isolate that if you took great pains to do so, but it's dominated by other things. So I don't believe the hype that, like, Liquid Glass is so much more processor intensive that it's making things slow down and causing your battery to drain. I do believe there are bugs that are causing things to slow down and make your battery drain, and those are the things to avoid. So I would say, if you're not updated to Tahoe and there's no thing that you really, really want out of, even if there is something you really, really want out of, like you like the new shortcuts features, or you want like to be able to put a dark mode, light mode toggle in your menu bar using the new control center thing, which is a thing that I do because it's convenient, still wait till 26.1. Do not upgrade to 26.0. 26.0 is bad. And the main culprit is, Casey, please tell us about it.
Yeah, so there's an Electron bug, because of course there is. The bug is being tracked on the Electron GitHub. It is number 48311. Avar Ayer writes, I believe I found the root cause, and it's not Apple's fault. It turns out Electron is overriding a private AppKit API underscore corner mask to apply custom corner masks to Vibrant views. This method is called by Windows Server to calculate the shadow of the window. I'm speculating that Apple uses some sort of memoization by reference, and this method breaks the memoization and forces Windows Server to repeatedly recalculate and repaint the shadow. What's particularly funny is that even a simple override that does nothing but call super, which is to say call its like parent, so to speak, still presents the issue. 95Mac writes, recent Electron versions no longer utilize this private API, and developers have begun updating their Electron version to mitigate the issue. There's a app, detector app by Thomas Kafka that Craig Hockenberry pointed us to and posted about that will look at your system and tell you which of the apps that you have on your system are offending. And there's also a website where you can go to that is all about shaming Electron, particularly for this specific bug. And you can see the status of a whole bunch of popular apps. And so we'll put all those links in the show notes.
So Electron is the web rendering engine used by lots of popular Mac apps because people don't want to make native Mac apps. They just want to wrap a web app in some Chrome. The Slack app that we're all running right now probably does that, and many, many others. They use the Electron engine. Electron engine has this bug. The Electron folks fixed the bug, but requires every single app that is built on Electron to update their version of the Electron engine that they're using and release a new version of their app that uses the new updated Electron version. And people are slow in doing that. I'm not sure these apps even always use the latest version of the Electron engine because, you know, that could affect things in the app. They might be a few versions behind or whatever. So this website, the Shame Electron thing, it's basically say, here are the popular apps that use Electron, and here are the ones that have been updated, and here are the ones that haven't. From what I've heard from the people who suffer from this bug, if you're using an Electron app every day and it hasn't been updated with this bug fix, again, do not upgrade to Tahoe because it's going to cause slowdowns, like system-wide slowdowns. I guess if you could not run Slack and not run but if you have to run those apps all day, don't upgrade to Tahoe. Now, again, is this technically Tahoe's fault? No, like it was an Electron using a private API, blah, blah, blah. But practically speaking, it means that if you're perfectly fine in Sequoia and then you upgrade to Tahoe and you're running five Electron apps all day, all of a sudden your whole system bogs down. And again, Dan Morin has that problem, and he's like, I think every single one of my apps has been updated to the new version of Electron, and still I'm getting these horrendous slowdowns that I can't explain. And that's 26.0. So just say no to 26.0. 26.1, maybe okay. Again, we'll see what Marco finds out about the tethering stuff. But like Tahoe is definitely a year where you might want to wait a little bit before upgrading, especially if, like Marco said, if there's no thing that you really, really want. Like, you know, if there's some feature that you got to have or some new setting or whatever, if there's nothing like that, just wait. Like, I think Rogo Mabus stuff is all updated. So technically I could update. Obviously I'm running Tahoe. I reboot this into Tahoe all the time to do dev stuff and test things. My laptop is running Tahoe over here. But like Marco, I feel no compulsion to upgrade. And unlike Marco, I go back and forth because my laptop's over there, my desktop's over here. I go back and forth between them all the time. And I just like how Sequoia looks better. So I definitely I have an attraction to not looking at that hideous UI and looking at it. And so I'm enjoying this one while I can. Even the simple things like the menu bar, like they made the menu bar transparent, and there's that option that says, like, oh, make the kind of like the clear and tinted option, the option on in Tahoe that says don't make the menu bar not be there. It instead of it being completely, you know, no background whatsoever, it gives it a background that's like the barest of tint. Like it's like a really like a 50% transparent black like tint thing. It's like, people who want that option, just make it opaque. Just like if they're clicking that option, they probably just want it opaque. And by the way, I have to use that option because if you don't use that option, it puts like a 1.5-inch gradient at the top of your screen that casts a gradient shadow onto the icons that are on your desktop, which I think that's a bug. Like it shouldn't do that.
Seriously.
It does the gradient to try to make the text more visible, like, or whatever. And it depends on what your desktop background is, because if your desktop background is very dark, it will do light. And if it's very light, it will do dark, and yada, yada. Right now in Sequoia, with my background that I'm using, my menu bar is whitish. But with this same background on Tahoe, my menu bar is blackish. And I don't like that, because then all my menu titles are in white. And anyway, I don't like how Tahoe looks, so I don't know when I'm going to upgrade, but I'm not being compelled to do so, especially since I can reboot into it whenever I want, and I have a laptop that's running it all the time.
All right, so it sounds like when 26.1 lands, presumably soon, then I'm probably okay. I'm just real nervous because I'm a very, very heavy Spaces user, and I believe Dan Morin had said that, you know, he is as well, and that's apparently been a little janky, so...
Yeah, like, that's one of the slowdowns, like, switching Spaces is, like, slow and stuttery, and people are like, is it because Liquid Glass is... Like, that's just a bug that some kind... And is it Electron-related? Doesn't seem like it, but maybe, but, like, I would say, like, Casey, what is making you want to update?
Nothing in particular. I mean, honestly, I'm sure that, well, right. I'm sure there's something there that I am interested in that I remembered, that I was like, during June, but whatever it is, I have forgotten about it since then. So, and granted, yes, haha, my memory, but no, I mean, I don't feel like there's anything that I've been like, yes, 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 it's finally time. You know what I mean? And so maybe I'll just hang on for another month or two and see what happens.
Yeah, I mean, there are cool features like the new control center thing that gives you more flexible, you know, customizable control center and put different menu bar icons in the menu bar. Although there's also bugs related to that. Someone posted a thing recently on their like MacBook Pro with some other laptop with a notch. The right half of the menu bar was gone. Like it just wasn't there anymore. The whole thing was like the, you know, the date and everything like that. I occasionally get like a weird thing where when I log in for the first time, the date and time is pushed off the right edge of the screen, and the only way to get it back is to log out and back in. That's in Sequoia. That bug has been around for ages. But their whole right side of the menu bar was just gone. There was nothing there, which is weird. But yeah, like there are cool features in there. Like there's the new phone app. People who like shortcuts, there's lots of cool automations there. Although, as you can imagine, with my recent bug experience, I'm a little bit wary of shortcuts these days. But if you don't upgrade to them, you don't miss those features. So, you know, just stick with what you've got, unless there's some reason that you want to upgrade. Maybe like 26.1 is surely going to be better than 26.0. I can tell you from an app developer's perspective, they've fixed tons of bugs. But have they fixed all the bugs in their OS? Has every Electron app updated? Maybe wait till 26.5.
Cool.
All right. Thank you to our sponsors. Oh, wait, we're done, right?
Yeah, we're done.
All right. Thank you to our sponsors this week, Claude, Skims, and Paca. And thanks to our members who support us directly. You can join us at atp.fm/join. One of the perks of membership is ATP Overtime, our weekly bonus topic. Every week, there is usually between 15 and 30 minutes more of the show that is in ATP Overtime for members only. This week in Overtime, we're going to be talking about making an app, an explanation of how an app is created for non-developers to kind of help understand the process. You can join, once again, to listen, atp.fm/join. Thanks, everybody, and we'll talk to you next week.
All right, what are we doing for after show? Oh, that's right, we're talking about stuff. Yeah, Vision Pro. All right, all right. Goodbye, Future Marco. I didn't even know you were here.
Neither did I.
right, John, so you've had some more time with, I'm going to call it your Vision Pro, at least for now. And I was wondering, you know, have you done any other things with it? You said in the main show that you, you know, tried another attempt at Mac Virtual Display and that went better. Have you done any of the other stuff? And like one of the things I was most curious about, and maybe this will be a short conversation if you haven't done it yet, but when we talked a few months ago, there was that Bono documentary one-man show thing, not documentary, like a one-man show that came out, and they had the same source material, but they treated it two very different ways. And there's a non-immersive version where it's just him on stage by himself chatting and talking to you slash at you. But the immersive version is way, way, way different with lots of animations and stuff. Have you had the time to at least watch a portion of the immersive version of the Bono thing?
That's when I talked about my experiences with the M2, with Casey's M2 Vision Pro, one of the things I left out was a lot of the stuff that I had already done with it, just because it's kind of some of the same things that you guys had already done. And one of those was watching a lot of the content. And so, yes, I did watch the immersive version of the Bono thing, not the whole thing, but I scrubbed around and watched because I'd seen the whole thing before and I didn't want to sit through the whole thing again. And it is very different. Like, they really do spend a lot of energy embellishing with graphics and stuff. Now, I'm not sure if it adds much to the experience. Like, it's certainly, there's lots of more visual flair and lots of interest, and makes it so there's more things for you to look at than just like the guy's face talking or whatever. But I'm not sure how successful it is artistically. It's an interesting experiment, but I feel like the boring, like, non-Vision Pro, you can just watch it on your television version, gets you most of that experience and maybe less distracting. So I wasn't that big of a fan of that. I did watch not all the other content. In fact, one of the things that I realized I forgot, because Steve Troughton-Smith's got a Vision Pro now and he's going through some stuff, and I forgot to try like the Disney immersive environments. Like, there's one for Alien Earth, which I just talked about in a recent Rectifs, and there's like Star Warsy ones, and like there's some Marvel stuff. Yeah, I have to try
Avengers,
that.
Avengers Campus is one of them, for example.
Yeah, I didn't do that Marvel thing that you watched. I'm going to watch that eventually. But I did watch like a lot of that one line of immersive content. I showed it to my wife with the demos, and she's like, "Where's all the immersive content?" I'm like, "You see that thing?" She's like, "That's it." I'm like, "That's it." I watched a bunch of that stuff. Surprisingly, one of the ones I found most affecting was the Highline one, where the woman is walking on a tightrope above thing. And I'm not particularly scared of heights, but I feel like that was an effective use of a thing that is, you don't get as big an effect on a flat screen as you do in a 3D appearance. I thought that was a cool one.
Did you do the parkour one in Paris? Because that was similar. I agree with you that the tightrope walking was more affecting, but that also had a similar vibe to it.
Well, I think the thing about it, I haven't done the Paris one yet. That's on my list. But like, I think part of the tightrope walking one is like, I'm not judging these just based on like how well it takes advantage of Vision Pro. I'm judging them the same way you, like, not technology wise, just like how good a story does it tell? Like, these are all very kind of short things. They're not, you know, they're more like little tone poems or whatever. Like, how effectively do they convey a story and emotion? And I felt like the Highline one did a good job of that, even though it is very similar structure to the other ones, just narrated by a person talking about that. I thought it was well written and affecting, and the visuals matched the other stuff. Mm-hmm. And by the same token, I also found the one with sharks, even though it's just like a bunch of sharks swim around you. That is very compelling content in 3D. I didn't think the story of that one was as good, but That's a good demo. And surprisingly, one of the other ones that I found was good, again, this is like has even less to do with Vision Pro and more to do with just the content, was the MotoGP one, the motorcycle riding.
I was just about to ask you.
The French motorcycle riding guy. Now, here's the thing. For reasons that make sense to me, they did not have Vision Pro cameras on the motorcycles. Like, they don't put them on the F1 cars, and the motorcycle is even smaller. Like, there's no room to put a gigantic, like, they're in a competitive race. Like, here, put this giant thing on the front of your bike. No thanks. So if you think you're going to be like, now I'm going to be like, it's like I'm riding the motorcycle. No, that's not what it is. Because this is actual competitive, as they say in the thing, it's like F1, but for motorcycles, right? They are professional motorcycle racers. They're trying to win a race. They don't care that Apple is there. So it was just shot like a documentary where, like, okay, the cameras were on the sidelines watching the motorcycles go by, and the cameras were on the guy when he was in, you know, getting ready in his trailer and talking, you know, to his coaches and everything like that. And the reason I found compelling was, one, I thought it was like a good story of, you know, this underdog athlete. It's a French rider. A French person has not won this French Grand Prix in like 70 years. And how is he going to do it? And he keeps falling and is having problems. And, you know, like it's underdog type sports story. One of the things I found most interesting about it was to get an up close look at those motorcycles, because that interests me.
Yeah.
Like, mm-hmm. like you're, because you're like, the cameras are like inches from these motorcycles. You can, and I guess it's part of the 3D is like, it feels like it's really there because you've got the 3D camera, but you're just looking at a but these motorcycles are amazing looking. I'm more interested in these than I am in F1 cars at this point, maybe because I know more about F1 cars than I do about the motorcycles, but like just how they're put together and how they differ from like a road bike, like these racing bicycles, and like the equipment that he puts on, and like just, I found that fascinating and super interesting, and I think I would have found that just as fascinating outside the Vision Pro, just a flat 2D thing. Because again, it wasn't really taking much advantage of the immersive thing. Maybe when you're up close to the motorcycle, but like that was interesting. I did watch Submerged. I didn't think it was very good.
Interesting. Why not?
Did the submarine fill with water?
Yeah, like it's just nothing to do with the Vision Pro-ness, just to do with the like short film. Like it's very challenging to make a compelling short film, and I think that one was like, I don't know if it was scripted well, and the number of events that took place, and the characterization, and just it didn't all work that well. If you have a fear of being submerged in water, maybe you'll find it more affecting. But blah, the Metallica one, I watched all of that one. I am not a Metallica fan, but I feel like I know what it's like to be in a Metallica concert now, and I think job done. Short film, right? Like it may, like if you're ever wondering what those shows are like, this is feels like what they're like. You know, like it gave me that experience, and it let me see the band performing. It was a little bit the production a little bit hokey, with sort of over dramatizing and slow-mo pans on the person's face backstage when they're probably bored out of their mind. But you get to see how the band performs, how what do people like about Metallica? I think it conveys that. Again, I don't particularly like Metallica, but you watch this and you understand what people like about Metallica. What do these fans like about it? What do they have to offer? Why are they a famous good band?
And before you move on from that, the moment that Marco and I talked about a lot, when the James Hetfield, I think is the singer's name, is like right in the face of the fan. And they actually did, I'm recounting from several months ago now, but they actually held the shot on that fan instead of following James as he walks away. And I just thought that was just such an incredible moment. And if I recall correctly, Marco, you felt very similarly.
Yeah.
Did that affect you in any way, shape or form? Or are you just kind of like, yeah, whatever?
Yeah, no, I remember you guys talking about it, and I wasn't looking for it, but when it came up, I'm like, oh, that must be the thing they were talking about, because it was affecting it. And here's the thing about all these little short films. The hard part is not the Vision Pro part. The hard part is making a compelling short film. That moment is compelling outside the Vision Pro. The reason you're reacting to that is because it's one of the more affecting moments in the short film, and other parts are less so. So, like, it's kind of like any kind of thing where there's a technology, you know, like the movie with like the, you know, the trains coming out of the screen with the first moving pictures. Like you can do that once or twice, but eventually it's like, okay, well, show me a compelling story. I'm no longer interested in the fascinating medium of the moving picture. Now you got to actually write a good script, good actors. And, you know, like, and I feel like Vision Pro, these little demo things demonstrate that, because very quickly the Vision Pro-ness takes a backseat to, is this a thing that I find interesting to watch? You know, and you can make interesting little short things, and you can also make ones that just feel kind of flat. And what I find is that very quickly, I started judging all these based on how much I would like them if I was just watching them on a TV. Even, like I said, even the Highline one, I think that's good, even if you're not in a Vision Pro. Now, the Vision Pro-ness adds to it, but that can only be an add. It can't make up for, you know, a bad script, a bad story, bad editing, or whatever. And the other thing I'll add in all this content that I'm watching, so far, I haven't watched the parkour one, so far, fingers crossed, zero motion sickness.
I'm genuinely shocked by that.
I'm as shocked as you are. I didn't have it in the demo either, but I'm like, of course, I saw very little things. I haven't watched the parkour one. I did watch all of the flying over like scenic places, like the Hawaii and all that stuff. I thought maybe that one would make me motion sick, but no, they fly so gently.
You know, I got to say, I am not prone to motion sickness, but, and I can't remember a specific example of a particular moment, but there's been times, particularly in flight, where not that I've been motion sick, but I've had a little bit of like maybe light vertigo where I'm kind of like...
In flight as in you're on an airplane wearing the Vision Pro?
No. I'm sorry. When you're doing like a Soarin' at Disney World, like, you're the perspective of the plane flying over.
Boundless, I think those called. Is that one?
Yeah. And I mean, this will happen to, or like... I think during Submerged, if I recall correctly, we talked about this, that there was a moment where the camera's moving and it's just kind of off-putting. Not I'm making it out to be worse than it is, but it's a little bit off-putting because your body expects to feel and all the feelings that you associate with your body moving because the camera is moving, but you're stationary and yet your body's expecting a feeling it's not getting. And it's a lightly off-putting, and I feel like I've gotten that from time to time when doing like flying scenes, which is weird to say, to hear you say that you're unaffected by it because you're affected by everything and I'm affected by nothing.
Yeah, like the flying ones, they fly so, like, they're not moving fast. They're not swooping. Yeah. Like, it's just more kind of like a slow movement over stuff. Like, I also watched the ice surfing in Iceland. I thought that story was interesting. But, you know, like, again, my memory of these and my ranking of them has nothing to do with the how well they take advantage of the Vision Pro. And, you guys talked a lot about, like, what's too much cuts, what's not enough or whatever. You're right that, like, cutting too much doesn't lend itself well to the Vision Pro. But also, again, if these were flat 2D, bad editing is bad editing, right? Like, it's difficult to pull this off with or without the 3D cameras. And it's a challenge to make compelling content. Yeah, so I haven't seen every single thing, but I've seen a lot of the stuff. And I will go back and watch the rest of it just because each one of them, I feel like, you know, I'd like to see someone, you know, and I don't blame like the Submerged people or anything. It's like, it's new technology. Let's figure out what we can do. Let's try some stuff. If the stuff you try doesn't work, like I think a lot of the shot design and editing in Submerged does not work, but someone's got to try to find that out. You know, on paper, it looks like it might be compelling. In practice, having shallow depth of field is not really great inside the Vision Pro because your eyes try to focus on the part that they can't focus on and it's never going to come into focus.
Yeah, that's the part that gives me, I think, a little bit of motion sickness, like, or at least like eye strain or like some version of it. Like whenever I try to focus on something that is not in focus and I can't focus on it, that messes with my feelings, I think, more than the motion does.
Yeah, we talked about this when we were before the Vision Pro came out about like having variable focal and the various technologies to do that, but that doesn't exist in the Vision Pro. It's a fixed focal distance. So when anything's out of focus, it will never be in focus. And the way that manifested, not for motion sickness, but for like eye-crossingly headache-inducing annoyingness, is on the Moto GP one, people talk in French and they have subtitles. And this is, I don't know if this is an inherent problem of the Vision Pro, but the choice they made to deal with this was difficult because here's the thing with the subtitles. The subtitles are on the screen as like a tinted black rectangle with white text on it or whatever, right? You're watching the Vision Pro, you're watching these guys, they're walking around by their motorcycle or they're sitting on a couch talking to each other, or he's riding on his stationary bike or whatever, and he's talking and the subtitle stuff appears. Very, very often, the subtitle stuff in like picture space on the screen was not at the depth it was in focus-wise on the screen, if that makes sense. Like,
my eyes
would try to focus on where the text would be if it was floating where it appears to be in the scene. Like, it looks like it's floating between this guy and that guy, or like 2 feet in front of the couch, but it's not there. I have to, like, to look at the subtitles, they're overlaid on top of everything. I have to focus at whatever the fixed focal distance of the display is, but my eyes would try to focus on not the fixed focal distance of the display, but like further into the image where it looks like that thing is hovering in the space of the 2D image that's behind it. And it would make me essentially go cross-eyed and double vision on. I couldn't read the subtitles because I kept double visioning. I'm like, why is this happening? Are the subtitles blurry? It's like, no, you keep thinking the subtitles are somewhere in the space of the scene. They're not. They're not in the scene. They are at the fixed focal distance of the display, and you have to focus on them there, even though looking at that part of the picture, which, by the way, you can see through the little subtitle thing, right? Even though focusing on that part of the picture, like Marco said, would require you to focus on a distance that is not the same as the focal distance of the Vision Pro. And so you're getting that, Marco, when you just see a blurry version in the, you know, on the screen, I'm getting it trying to read the subtitles. And that's a difficult problem because it's so convincing that the subtitles are there floating in the scene that it causes my eyes to pick the wrong focal distance. Now, maybe I could get used to it, or maybe they could put the subtitles lower down or make them opaque, or I don't know, like make them go edge to edge so that it's so clear that they couldn't possibly be floating between the ottoman and the couch, you know? Like, it's a tricky problem to have, but it's something I didn't think of before. Like, subtitles in a fixed focal length VR, subtitles, your brain might think they are not where they are and you might get double vision.
Yeah, it's very, when you're, I don't know if it's just like me or my eyes or the way my eyes work. I don't know what it is, but like when I, like in real life, in regular life, as I have needed reading glasses for up close focus over the last, you know, three to 4 years, one thing I have noticed is like when I am not wearing reading glasses or progressives, and when I try to look at something up close that I can't get sharp, it causes similar kind of like eye strain. Like I think people who have lived with imperfect vision for their whole lives, maybe they're more used to it than I am, and maybe it doesn't have the same, you know, effect or noticeability for them. But for me, it's like really uncomfortable, and I start getting like headaches and eye strain, and you know, like it's very uncomfortable for me to be unable to focus on something that I'm trying to read or look at. And so I switch to glasses whenever possible, or avoid doing those things, you know, close up when I can't. In the Vision Pro, nothing is ever that much in focus, and I have the reading inserts for it. They don't seem to make a difference for the distance that it's rendering things at. And it's because of, as we were mentioning earlier, all of those different layers of image processing and slight, you know, softening or sampling or warping that are occurring to make all the optics work in the Vision Pro. Nothing in the Vision Pro is super sharp to my eyes. Some things are more than others, but like nothing is really, really sharp all the time. And when I'm watching immersive video, that is made even more obvious to me. And part of that's just because immersive video oftentimes is not shot super high resolutions, or not delivered at super high resolutions yet because everything is so young around it. But also part of that is just like the screens and the realities of it and the optics of things not being fully in focus. And so when I'm watching that immersive video, so often I'm feeling that same eye strain feeling that as if I'm trying to read my phone without my glasses on, and I can't quite get it sharp, and it really throws me off, and it makes me feel like kind of unwell and certainly unpleasant. And I don't know if I'll ever be able to solve that problem. That might just be how my eyes react to that kind of thing. Maybe this will just never work for me. I don't know.
I think the eye strain you're talking about, like it's less familiar to me because I'm nearsighted, which means I can't see things far away. And when you can't see things far away, there is no thing that my understanding, at least my experience, and some optometrists can write in and tell me if I'm wrong about this, is that there's nothing the muscles that squish your eyeball can do to make you see things far away better. They're far away. The muscles can't push. They can only pull. That's all muscles do, is they contract. They either contract or don't contract. And there's not two opposing sets of muscles, one of them that pulls your eyeball out of your face and one of them pulls your eyeball in. There's no, right? If you're looking at something that's up close, what you're trying to do is have those muscles in your eye squish your eyeball so that it can focus on the things that are closer to you. And as you get older, your lens gets less flexible because it gets harder and yellowed and gross and just like the rest of your body. And the lens doesn't squish as much, but damned if your muscles in your eye won't try to squish it. And that's, I feel like, that eye strain feeling. I can get that by either putting on my distance contacts or putting on my distance glasses and trying to look at my phone screen. And my eyes are like, come on, squish those friggin' lenses just a little bit more and you'll be able to focus. And it's never going to happen because mm-hmm. you're old and lenses just aren't going to squish like that anymore. And you get eye strain. If that's happening inside the Vision Pro, like maybe, I don't know what the solution is, but like I went back and forth on this back when the Vision Pro came out, and also for this M2 one to figure out what I was going to do with my contact lenses and stuff. I'm pretty sure Apple recommends, according to all the texts that I could find, that you use your distance glasses prescription in the Vision Pro, which makes me think, Marco, that you should not be using any kind of lenses. If you don't need glasses to drive, if your distance vision is uncorrected, then you shouldn't have any lenses in the Vision Pro.
Yeah, I've tried it both ways. Like I spent significant time with it, both with no corrections and with the plus one reading glasses, reading inserts, and it doesn't seem to make much of a difference. Like I really can't tell any difference at all when I use them.
Do you get less eye strain with no inserts?
No, it's exactly because. When I'm looking in the Vision Pro, the sharpest things in the Vision Pro are the UI. It's like the windows, the controls. Those are actually the sharpest things. What is not sharp is video content. And it seems like it's a combination of like low resolution of the signal and also, you know, the optics of not having everything in the scene be in focus. Looks good to me. It always looks a little bit soft, a little bit blurry, or a lot blurry if I'm trying to, you know, look around the scene more. And the only way I can watch immersive video on the Vision Pro without having really bad eye problems or motion sickness or other things is if I diligently never look at the periphery, if I only look straight ahead and never look around the scene, which is really hard because you can see the whole scene, so I always want to look, hey, what's over there? Like, it's really hard to not look
around. And to be
clear,
what you're talking about is moving your eyeballs, not moving your head.
Yes. Like, I want to look around the scene, and maybe even move my head a little bit, sure.
Well, because moving your head, you can keep your eyes focused on the center of the display is where most of the information is.
Yeah, but the problem is the video itself is not shot with the edges of the scene in focus. But
well,
you can sort of. And
that comes down to what the video content is. But like I was saying, when I was comparing the iPad to the Vision Pro, I can tell that the Vision Pro has less dots per degree than the iPad held at the distance close to my face that in my Retina iPad. It looks softer, but I mean, TV looked softer before it was HD as well. We're fine with it. Like 720p versus 1080 versus 240 or whatever a standard def was. I like softer video with less information bothers me less. It seems like your eyes are constantly trying to make those sharper as if you have like your distance glasses on and you're trying to read look at your phone without your reading glasses, right? And you're like, if my eyeballs just squish a little bit, surely that becomes sharper. But like, you're never going to add more pixels to that display. And maybe your vision is good enough to really see the limitations of them. I see the softness as well. Like I said, with Mac Virtual Display, I see how much less crisp it is than the actual display, but I also see how much more crisp it is than the 3K display on the Intel thing. But my eyes are not saying, if only you squish more, that will get sharper. It's just I'm accepting of the resolution that it is. And speaking of Steve Trautman-Smith, who's got his as well, he's like, I don't think they need to add any more pixels to these display. I disagree. I think you disagree as well, Marco. They need to add more pixels to these display. Like, it's not pressing, but like, technology should march on in the next few decades if they can add twice or four times as many pixels to these displays. First of all, field of vision has to get bigger. Like the FOV, I forget what it is, but it is narrow, and that could be much better. And second of all, even within the existing FOV, we need more pixels. Like, I think you should be able to get it so that it is the same number of pixels per degree as a Retina display at normal viewing distances. And even then, I would say you could go a little bit farther if you wanted to make it look more realistic than a Retina display, because let's be honest, even though I can't see the Retina pixels, you can kind of see them a little bit if you get real close. So,
do you have? I'm sorry, maybe you said this and I missed it. Do you have Zeiss inserts yet, or no?
I do not. I'm working on that, but I currently do not have them. So I'm knowing that I have to do vision, my distance vision, I am trying to cobble together a set of distance vision contact lenses from old and new contact lenses that I have hanging around, because unfortunately my eyes are different from each other, and my actual real current contact prescription intentionally has one eye for distance and one eye for up close, which sounds terrible, but it's better than not being able to read your phone with your contacts in, believe me. And your brain gets used to it, right? So I'm cobbling together a slightly inaccurate prescription with contacts. Which means every time I want to use the Vision Pro, I have to put in contacts, because as soon as I'm done using the Vision Pro, I need to take those out because I cannot use a computer or a phone with those contacts in it.
Yeah. Oh my God.
So it's kind of an ordeal to use the Vision Pro, which is, if and when I get lens inserts, that will go a long way towards making it easier just to pop on the Vision Pro. What I will say, though, is I've become very good at using the Vision Pro without contacts in. Like, I take off my glasses and I put on the Vision Pro, and it's as blurry as hell in there. It's like, you know, 2350, 24, like whatever my vision is like without them. But if you know what the UI looks like and, you know, can sense changes in like saturation and brightness, like I can actually use the UI. The problem is, like, when I was trying to like, I was trying to test the like hold down on the X button thing that, who was it? That Nick wrote in about. I'm like, oh, let me put the Vision Pro on and try that. So here I am, blurry in the Vision Pro. I get the X button. I pinch to hold down. The menu pops up. I'm like, does that say hide others, maybe? Like, if, because I knew what it was supposed to say beforehand, I could believe it. And then, you know, I could select the option and do it or whatever. So I don't recommend using the Vision Pro that way. But let's be honest, if I take off my glasses and walk around the house, it's a very similar experience.
Gracious. So, sitting here now, what, a week and a half, 2 weeks in, or whatever it's been, of Vision Pro "quote unquote" ownership. Granted, the price was incredible, so the price was right for you. But do you, on a broad level, and I'll probably ask you this again in a couple of weeks, are you enjoying it? Do you not like it? Is it burdensome? Is it fun? Is it crappy? What is your current thinking on a macro level?
I like having it here. It's a fun, cool gadget to play with. I'm glad I didn't pay for it.
Fair.
Like, it's ideal. Like, yo, if someone's gonna lend you one for free for a while, sure, yeah, it's great. If someone offers you that, take it. You know, it's a cool thing to try out. But when I have to send it back to you, I'm probably not gonna be too broken up about it.
Fair enough. All right, let's do some titles. Apparently the showbot croaked, because I think IRC croaked halfway through the night. Let's see.
What could possibly go wrong about long-running assumptions that both IRC and WebSockets might, either one might break.
I'm not sure why IRC croaking would affect the showbot, and honestly, it happens so infrequently that I don't care. let's see here.
Let's see. Are you calling these? You want me to?
Well, it's working now. I'm just saying we lost the first, like, 20, 30
minutes.
I went
to it, and there was nothing.
No, it's working for me right now. Do you want me to send you a screenshot?
No, I'm just doing it the old-fashioned way. Hang on.
Instead of me sending a screenshot, you're going to write some Perl.
I'm not writing any Perl.
Regex.
At the moment.
Just the same. Yeah, right, exactly. I'm not in love with any of these, to be honest with you.
These all kind of suck.
I don't have vote counts in here.
Did we have better ones from earlier before the crash?
I've got all the ones from the chat right here.
Okay, hold on. What do we mean by right here?
I'm assuming he's
right in front
Slack.
Of me.
Oh, well, can you dump them in Slack or just pick out a couple options for us? Just pick out a couple options.
I'm doing
like
a little bit of cleanups. Lots of people did test, though. Was that you testing?
No, it wasn't me.
All right. Well, I don't know.
Okay.
If I copy and paste these all in, let's see. If I do it, is it going to be too much? It's probably going to cut it off. Anyway, let's see.
Holy shmikes.
Whoa.
I do like stab that okay.
A lot of these are from last week.
Oh, yeah, I just did select all in the scroll back. Sorry.
Yeah. Let's see. I think we starting out it with like casual
put the helmet
K
on
numbers
your face.
Or.
Yeah, 6016 has got to be from this week. So
it is.
That's
yeah.
Probably that's the start of like.
Defend the honor of the Cheesecake Factory. That's pretty good.
Long, but it's good. Let's see.
I kind of like the Cheesecake
Wearing
Factory.
Mine in my heart.
What was that about?
The Mac Pro shirt.
Oh, that is good. I
good,
do like that.
But I kind of like the Cheesecake Factory one better.
I mean, I it's long, but I'm not against it.
I think it's great.
I would put defending the honor of the Cheesecake Factory.
That's fine. I like
I can
way.
Do it either way. Yeah, same.
Yeah.
All right, let's just go with that. I don't feel
defending.
Like about it. All right. All right, give me vamp for a second while I get all this together. Hold on. All right. Defending the honor of the Cheesecake Factory. And for the 95th episode in a
row, they
should
sponsor the show.
Ask ATP. Yes.
I'm sure they'll get right on that.
All right. Mm-hmm. They do a lot of podcast advertising.
All right. Is everyone else good?
They don't need to advertise. You need to go there, Marco. Make a trip of it. I think there's one near your car dealership.
Well, then how about this? The next time you come visit and we go to Goose together in Richmond, we'll go to Cheesecake.
Don't
Factory.
Waste it on like when you're visiting somebody. It's not, don't like, it should, it's just a thing that you should do once, but not with the expectation that it's going to be amazing. But it's.
Oh, shoot. I forgot a link.
Also, John is somehow right. There is one near my car dealership.
I know. I know there is. I know where your car dealership is. I know it's near the pizza place that you should go to that has good pizza that you've gone to already, but you've done that. Check. So now, Cheesecake Factory.
Wait, oh, your pizza place?
Yeah. Isn't that near your car dealership, too?
No, there is also a Cheesecake Factory near there.
All right, well, there's a lot of cheese. The point is that it's not an obscure restaurant.
They seem to put them only near BMW dealerships.
I'm not sure that's congruous, but whatever.
I think they just put them literally everywhere in the country.
But, like, there's
it's
only four on Long Island? Five of you? Yeah, I guess Brooklyn
is Long Island is weird that way. Like I've said to you before, when I moved away from there, as to my knowledge, there was not a single Kmart or Walmart on all of Long Island. I'd never been to one in my life. I'd heard about them. I knew they were a nationwide chain, but there was none. That's not the true case right now. But when I was there, like chain penetration to Long Island was surprisingly weird. And they had Long Island has its own weird chains like King Cullen and stuff, which was, I believe was one of the first supermarkets in the entire United States, but didn't really expand nationwide. So we'd be going to King Cullen and be like, what? They have King Super with two O's in Colorado, which I think is dumb. But King Cullen, of course, makes perfect sense. King Super.
So grumpy. All right, goodbye, live people. Thank you for being live people.